Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Down in Front. Our movie this week is, Back to the Future. Pop in your DVD, your Blu-ray, plus play, press pause when the Universal logo before the movie, immediately before the movie, goes to black.
The old school
The
Universal
80s
logo.
Van Allen belt.
We had at least two Universal logos. The last Universal logo before the film fades to black, press pause. In a second, I'll say 3, 2, 1, unpause, which one? I'll press play, you'll press play, watch the movie here, but they sing a little bit. Anyway, that's when you pause in the movie. My name is T. Christie. I'm sitting here with my friend Brian William Fenifter.
Greetings!
Michael Dorkman Scott.
How are we going to do this movie and you don't say Michael Great Scott? That's what, come on.
And Trey the Amazing
Turn
Stokes.
Turn your badge and gun.
Hi.
You're a loose cannon, Marine. Back to the Future was a movie that, let's, before we even start about our little intro summaries, why have we taken 3 years to do Back to the Future, y'all?
Because the hedgehog saw his shadow.
Well, people on the forum just kept asking about it in six months.
It just became a thing.
It was one of those things that, like, it turns into a thing, and nobody really knows how it turned into a thing. It just was it was a thing.
The thing was, every time someone would ask us for Back to the Future, we'd just say, oh, that's 6 more weeks, we're not going to record it.
I think the real reason is, first of all, this podcast was an offshoot of a podcast you used to do that we all participated in called Geeksa, where you had done Back to the Future.
Yep.
So we didn't want to start by doing Back to the Future again, because you'd only comparatively recently done Back to the Future, and there's a whole commentary from Geeks about Back to the Future, and then it just became we just avoided doing Back to the Future, because once we got our sea legs under us, we sort of realized, like, we might have a hard time saying anything about Back to the Future.
We've gotten pretty good at picking movies where we're like, I don't think we can actually really talk about that movie, and sometimes they're surprising, just like perfect movies are surprising sometimes. Sometimes it's like, surely you guys can talk about Back to, we'll find out. We'll see.
I'm on record that I still don't know if we're going to have anything interesting to say about Back to the Future.
I'm also on that record.
I'm excited. Anyway.
If you're hearing this, we did.
Yeah. Or not.
Back to the Anthropic principle, it'd work.
Yeah. Back to the Future is one of those movies I grew up with. I was lucky enough to get to grow up with it, unlike a lot of 80s movies that my folks didn't care about. They did care about this one, so it was something that I had. And then this and Back to the Future 2, we got on VHS, and then Back to the Future 1 broke. So I grew up on Back to the Future 2.
Wow.
Which was kind
Thank
of interesting.
Thank you, VHS.
I know, right? And the, I did it to myself. I broke that VHS. But it's obviously great. It's a lot of fun. It works for me on several levels. It's a well plotted. It's well written. It actually deals with the time travel in a way that doesn't cause my balls to revert to tadpole legs.
It doesn't call your balls to shrink back up and undrop.
No,
just for the sake of argument, what would be a movie that does that? just FYI,
2010 Moby Dick.
Okay,
it's a lot of fun. But now these days, in addition to just one of those movies that I know like the back of my fucking hand, and I know the back of my hand pretty well. It's also.
Oh hey, what's that thing?
Now I'm looking at Teague's hand. I'm like, you've got a scar on your hand.
We'll
talk about that later. Let's talk about that.
I remember when that happened.
He didn't have that yesterday.
The cool thing about living in the Valley is that we're all around. Like my Burger King, the Burger King I go to when I want a Whopper, is the Burger King in the beginning of the movie where he grabs onto the truck and it's pulling out of a drive-thru. That's that Burger King. Like I'm surrounded by Back to the Future shit these days. So in addition to being a big fan of the movies, like my life looks a lot like the Back to the Future neighborhood and shit like that, because we just live in the same area. It's great. It's wonderful. And Back to the Future 2 is arguably the best time travel movie of all time, just in terms of how unbelievably great it deals with these recursive themes where it's like, we've been here before, but we're doing this differently, and it doesn't make any fucking sense. But the plotting of it works, like, perfectly. It's amazing. Anyway, Back to the Future is great. I'm a big fan of it. We got to see it live at the New Bev, or not live, but we got to see a big print of it at the New Bev.
The feature of the whole thing.
Just big old fan. I don't know what we're going to say about it, but we'll talk for 2.5 hours, Back to the Future length conversation.
We are drinking.
Hell yes.
We'll find out. We were preparing by drinking for the last couple things we recorded before this, just to make sure. But, Brian?
Very similar to you. I grew up on this film. This is, I'm sure it also applied to Indiana Jones, Star Wars, and everything. But this, more than any other movie in our VHS collection, I distinctly remember as watching so many times that it just demagnetized the tape and it was no longer viewed. I remember it got to the certain point where I wanted to watch Back to the Future and I couldn't because the tape had been viewed so many times that it was just demagnetized and just all staticky and just unwatchable.
Now people are nostalgic for that.
Yeah. And so it's like,
you guys are retarded.
I think the one smart thing I feel like I have to say about this movie is I think, you know, the...
Don't blow your wad.
Yeah, blow right at the front. Yeah.
Here it comes.
We can talk more about this maybe, hopefully, if there's anything worth talking about. But, cinema language, cinema grammar, and the idea of, you know, scenes and shots and reverse shots and everything, the whole cinema language is not a language that we're born with. It's not something that is inherently hardwired into our brain. It's something we have to learn. And it's something we do learn over the process. And I think my speculation is that children tend to pick one or a couple movies and rewatch them over and over and over again, and very distinctly, that movie goes from a process of just some crazy random fucking sounds and images that come at you and don't really mean anything but are fun to watch, and over time, rewatching it many, many times, you gradually teach yourself the language of cinema. And for me, personally, I feel that movie was...
Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Raiders of the Lost Ark was definitely one of them, but more than any other was Back to the Future, and the other one was Star Trek IV: The Voyage Home. But Star Trek IV and Back to the Future, I feel like I have this very distinct memory of watching them and not having any idea what the fuck was going on. It was just random series of images and people doing things, and then gradually understanding, okay, this scene connects to that scene. They're saying this, but what they actually mean is this.
This movie was your Mavis Beacon.
Wow.
I don't actually even get that reference.
It's amazing that Mavis Beacon is a reference now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mavis Beacon teaches typing.
Yeah. And Brian's like, okay. And Leia Thompson, my first boy-girl thing.
Yeah,
Leia Thompson. Oh, my God.
Yeah, all right. But that's Howard the Duck, though.
No, it's both.
Brian, okay. Stop licking the microphone. Anyway, Dorkman, do you like Back to the Future? Are you a fan?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Come on.
It's all right.
Back to the Future is great, and if you disagree, you're Hitler. I mean, that's just how it works.
Somewhere on the planet, there's somebody who doesn't like Back to the Future, and I want to smack that person right now.
It's a great movie.
You're
gonna
miss everything cool and die angry.
What kind of person doesn't like Back to the Future?
Here's the thing. My thought about it is, if you actually look at it, because we have slammed movies that made more sense than Back to the Future does on some levels. Like, we have taken some movies to task for not making sense. And there are definitely, just as T said, there are aspects of Back to the Future, especially the time travel bit, like the rules of time travel. I'm not talking about the magic bean of the flux capacitor, because that's like, what does it do? It travels through time. How? By capacitating the flux. Shut up. Yeah. Like, that's fine. But then actually trying to sort out the time travel rules, especially as, like, they compound during the trilogy, like, you could not make sense of that with a gun to your head. But the
fortunately we have the internet.
what I'm interested in, what I think may give us some distance in terms of talking about
some mileage
yeah, is
perhaps this, 88 miles.
Why does this movie we don't care. Nobody who watches this movie cares about any of those things. Like, it's crafted on this complete hammock of fridge logic. And if you think about it later, you're like, wait, what? And you go back and watch it, you're like, that still doesn't make sense, but I don't care.
It's Wile E. Coyote logic. As long as you just keep moving forward, you're fine. If you look down, you drop.
Exactly.
Oh, I'm in midair.
Exactly. So that's what I'm interested in maybe talking about and getting some mileage out of, exploring why this movie works when so other movies of this type can fail.
Right.
Trey, Back to the Future?
Yeah.
Where were you in 85?
Yeah.
Were you 5 years old like the rest of us?
I was. No. I was 5 years out of college. No, I was 3 years out of college.
I was actually 2 years old.
You're not my
old.
Real dad.
Actually, funny you should mention, but...
We talked about this. You don't go there.
On a very special episode, say hi to your mom.
Gail Christie is a saint.
Say hi to your mom for me. This movie came in that very special time of my life when I was out of film school and realized that I was never going to work in the film industry, which I counted my beginning to work in the film industry with basically The Blob in 88. I did like a small movie before then that no one's ever seen. So this was one of those, seeing this movie and go, oh my God, that was another one I didn't get to work on. God, it was so mad. I was pissed because it was such a great movie and I wasn't in it. I wasn't involved in any way. And I reckon I knew the name Zemeckis because Zemeckis had done, before this he'd done Romancing the Stone, which is his first really big hit. And before that, he'd done two other movies that both are worth watching. One is I Want to Hold Your Hand, and the other is Used Cars, which I especially like. It's a crazy movie. But Zemeckis was a name that, coming out of USC Film School, was almost on a level with Lucas, because he was just a year or two behind Lucas at USC Film School. And right next to all the awards that Lucas won that were sitting in trophy cases at the Norris Cinema Theater at USC were a bunch of awards that Zemeckis won. And we saw his student films, because he wasn't a big, big movie director yet, but he was making Hollywood movies, so they made us watch his movies like they made us watch George Lucas's student films. And their student films, Lucas's student films are just as bad as anyone else's student films. But Zemeckis's student film was awesome. And I was like, wow, that guy, why isn't he bigger than Lucas? Because that guy's really got it going on. And I Want to Hold Your Hand came out, and it was like critically like, this is actually a pretty good movie, but it wasn't a big hit. Used Cars was like, yeah, it wasn't a big hit, but it's fun. You should check it out. And then he made Romancing the Stone. That was a big hit, which led to then this being, the movie that, of course, he's been Zemeckis ever since this movie came out. But I love the movie. I was like, oh, what a fun movie. I mean, again, this is that weird phase of the 80s when the TV kids like me took over the asylum and got to make movies that were these big synthesized blobs of pop culture that we'd all been raised in, you know, and Lucas and all those guys. And this was just one of those, where it's like, you know, it's exactly the kind of movie that we all had been wishing Hollywood was making, and now we were finally getting a chance to do it. So I thought, so I was like, God, that's great. You know, Gremlins and, you know, Back to the Future and all those movies that were getting made right around that time. So it's amazing, and it holds up, you know, amazingly well. And it's amazing that it's a period piece now, looking back at that, you know, it's like, I mean,
on two levels.
How does the math work? It's like we are as far away from 1985 as 1985 was from 1955 at the time.
Pretty close.
Close to it, yeah.
Which means,
of course, well, it's 2015.
In movie logic, three flying cars are only 3 years away now.
Right.
So.
And power laces, which they have now.
The future.
And the hoverboard.
But it's a great movie. And that's the problem.
Anyway,
what are we going to say for the next 2 hours?
You're at the point where the Universal logo has faded to black, like we are here. Put your finger on the button.
The second Universal logo, the 1985 Universal logo.
Yeah.
Three, back in time. 3, 2, 1, unpause.
Back when Universal was an MCA company.
Your jacket is now dry.
That's the next one.
Oh, I love this font. See, this is what happens.
Here's the
problem. Okay, we're not even trying yet. We've already devolved to the font. We're not even trying.
Now, there is a...
You've got to imagine how little sense this title makes. People are like, what?
Yeah, I know. It's a nonsense title. Before this movie came out, like, Back to the Future. You kind of could tell it did feel like, okay, it's going to be a time travel movie of some kind.
I think it's actually it's high concept.
I'm going to cut you off real quick.
Go ahead.
Because it's a topical thing and it's an on-screen thing. That I've seen people talk about, there's a Harold Lloyd clock here.
Yeah.
The Harold Lloyd clock. Where people say, oh, see, Doc Brown.
Hanging off the clock there,
Brown knew all along because he's even got a clock of himself doing it. That is Harold Lloyd.
Yeah.
That's a clock you could buy at the time, just like these cat clocks and the poodle clocks and everything else. That's a clock you would just buy.
But it is a cute reference.
It's Harold Lloyd from Safety Last, which is a classic silent movie. And that's what this movie is referencing.
Yeah. Harold Lloyd!
It's foreshadowing.
It's foreshadowing and an homage at the same time.
Yeah.
Which
that's smart shit.
That's the brilliance and genius of the efficiency of Back to the Future is that, as we talked about before, it's, you know, and whenever you have a scene or whenever, you know, at any moment, there should be more than one thing going on at a time. And so that's a brilliant example of
this, by the way, is a Zemeckis trope.
I was going to say, isn't it commonly accepted now that it's kind of lazy to do the pan across the messy room
intro? Some
people
are tired of it, but Zemeckis uses it a lot. It's a common thing where he tells you all about a character by showing you, you know, the things he has on display in his home. He's done it as recently as Castaway is the most recent one I can think
Which,
of.
Which Zemeckis opened a movie in Trey's house, it would be this weird serial killer thing.
Yeah, exactly.
With like fucking ventriloquist dummies and old books and laser discs.
That actress, by the way, that's a cameo. She was the lead actress in Used Cars, playing the newscaster there.
How great would it be to do this whole sequence establishing who this character is and all the nuances and facets of it, and then the actual character is completely different. The very fastidious and, you know, into this and into that, and then the actual character, once they're introduced, is nothing like that at all.
And it's all one take, too, by the way. So this is
so good.
It's a very Rube Goldberg machine-esque.
It's one cutaway for the dog food, but then it goes back to the take. You were saying.
The Back to the Future, I think, is a great, you know, they talk about the importance of things being high concept these days, and that it has to, you know, it has to be high concept in the sense that it has to grab you from a very little amount of information. The idea has to be so good that it has to grab you immediately. And I think ultimately what that means underlying everything else is just like, what is the two most contrasting things you can juxtaposition against each other, and what is the interesting product that is created out of juxtapositioning those two things? And then that's high concept. And I think the very title of Back to the Future is a great illustration of that, of the idea of going back to the future.
God, that shot is masterful.
Yeah. CRM 114 is a 2001 Space Odyssey.
But just consider...
Dr. Strangelove.
Dr. Strangelove, and then it does
and
it, pop
in
up.
In 2001, it's a Dr. Strangelove reference.
You're right.
We not only learned a little bit about the character, but we've got a lot of...
information. A huge amount of backstory.
Yeah, we've got a lot of
backstory. We know that Doc Brown stole plutonium. We don't know why, but you know, we're already up to that level.
And we know because
that
of
that he squandered a fortune.
That he squandered a fortune, and because of his little Rube Goldberg device, the pile of food and stuff like that, is like neither he nor his dog have been home for a while.
Right.
Yeah. I want to talk to Michael J. Fox's character Marty McFly here for a second.
Okay.
Your guitar sucks.
Yeah.
That's a weird guitar.
Your guitar sucks, sir.
It doesn't matter. Look at the amp.
Yeah. Where did he convince Doc to get this for him? What's going on here?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Is like, did he convince Doc to build this for him?
I never thought that. I just thought it was, you know, it's just one of Doc's
Doc
many
Brown has some random shit.
One of Doc Brown's many inventions. He's the movie scientist in which scientist is a job.
Right.
As if, you know, a scientist can do anything because he's a scientist.
Right.
He's a generalist scientist.
Yeah. Oh, look at his postcards from the Edge sunglasses there. That's adorable. Yeah. How do you guys feel about Michael J. Fox?
He's amazing.
Didn't feel nothing about him before this movie, but like most of the world, it was like afterwards, he was Michael J. Fox.
Have you guys seen the behind-the-scenes stuff with Eric Stoltz? How'd you feel about that?
Yeah.
Apparently there's a new version coming out that shows even more.
The Blu-ray, right?
Yeah, the Blu-ray, I guess, has a lot of the footage.
Because I remember distinctly...
By the way, for anyone who might not know, they filmed the first 2 weeks of Back to the Future with an actor named Eric Stoltz.
More than that. It's like 6 weeks or something.
Yeah, it was like half.
Yeah, and it wasn't working out, and they recast it and reshot all those scenes.
I remember distinctly my mind being blown upon learning the act that the guy from Pulp Fiction was Marty McFly for 2 weeks.
It's amazing.
And then later I learned it was 6 weeks, and my mind was blown a second time.
It's really shocking. I mean, again, I think that's the Spielberg influence that they didn't just pull the plug. They were like, oh, just, you know,
I mean,
like, the fact that you can go to the studio and go, look, I know we've been shooting for 5 weeks.
Yeah.
But, you know, and what studio wouldn't go, you go with the guy you've got now at this point. What are you talking about?
Can you imagine that happening today?
It's that they're not on that scale. No, I really can't. And of course, you know, there's a few shots where it's still Eric Stoltz. I think the one where he dives into the DeLorean is still Eric Stoltz. And a few other things that might have been Eric Stoltz's feet we were watching in that shot we just saw, for all we know, you know, or standing, because it didn't have to be either one.
Not to say that it doesn't happen in modern day, because it happens in the Firefly pilot. They had Castanara, and then they
here comes my Burger King.
Shooting one half a day with an actor.
Yeah, that's one day of filming.
Same thing happened in Lord of the Rings. It was one
that's
day.
That's true. With Aragorn,
my
right?
Burger
with
King. Yeah. Still there, and there's the Ari, the lighting store right there. There's the Toys R Us is still there.
Probably the biggest example, but it wasn't nearly as damaging, was V for Vendetta. Where James Purefoy was the original V, and
still
is in many shots, and they just redubbed.
Yeah, but that's easy.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. It's not nearly as extreme an example.
If you happen to be in Los Angeles, it's in the Burbank area, Victoria and Magnolia.
Victory.
And Magnolia. Well, now we're
on the back.
This is the Universal back.
Now we're next to our house.
Which is no longer there because
you can see
down.
This from where we are right now. I have always wanted to do this.
As we pointed out way back when we did the Gremlins commentary, you see the exact same backlot as
the
Gremlins commentary.
We'll talk about it in a second, Brian, but I want to talk about it too. But no, they did the re-release last year where they put it, like, 25th year anniversary. They put it back into theaters for like 2 days or something like that. And I knew that was that Burger King right there. And that Burger King is about a mile, a little less than a mile away from the movie theater we were going to see the show at. And I spent all of a day on Twitter trying to get in touch with someone with a truck who wouldn't mind me doing it. I wouldn't mind getting arrested for it. I just wanted to get pulled by a truck. I'd be wearing a helmet and shin guards, Mom. Pulled by a truck from that Burger King to the movie theater. I thought that would be amazing. And I would get all sorts of weirdo press. I didn't do it because I thought I would die.
That's a good reason.
Yeah. But no, Brian and I...
Not a great reason, but okay.
Go ahead and tell the story, Brian.
Well, we haven't done one in a while, though. Occasionally, we decide to do random location adventures. We'll go up to Vasquez Rocks. We went to the office location. One day, we decided... There's some guy, and we should really find... Before this commentary is out, we should find this guy and his link. Some guy who has really meticulously gone through, it might be many movies, but distinctly Back to the Future, and figured out, okay, this is the location, this scene is this location, this scene is that location, and really gone through and figured it out exactly. So you can go, and he's visited each one in turn, each piece of it.
Bigwaste.com/BTTF.
There you go.
Big Waste. Okay, fair enough.
And so... Teague and I, we had one Saturday free where we weren't doing anything. Like,
Brian, we live next to all the Back to the Future stuff.
Let's go do all of it. And the thing is, a lot of these Back to the Future locations are spread out through the Los Angeles area. So it's a day's worth of
driving. Yeah, Marty's house is in Sunland. All the 55 houses and Doc Brown's house are in Pasadena.
The mall is in City of Industry.
Mall's in City of Industry. The school's in Whittier. It's all over the place.
But Teague and I...
We fucking did it.
And
if
we
have
photos from it.
Go to twitvid.com and click on any user so you can find out what the naming convention is. And then just make that username Brian Finifter. And you can see a video of me, Brian, shot at the mall, enacting the entire scene like an asshole. Hey, look.
Huey Lewis.
Is that the news?
That is most definitely not the news.
See,
we're already quoting the Geeks episode.
most definitely not the news.
Now, this is one of the things I think we can assume right up front. Perfect movie? Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
100%.
Yeah. And it's because it really is, there are very few movies that are this intricate in terms of setup and payoff.
Yes.
They've already set up about 8 things, and they've got about...
Did that license plate say For Marty? Did you just see that?
I'll rewind it later.
Okay. I doubt that's what it would say.
It said for something. It was a vanity plate.
Yeah.
It for MAR something.
Yeah. Anyway, perfect movie just being that it sets up a bunch of stuff and it pays them off all immaculately.
Yeah. So we've already said the Strickland had three payoffs in it alone. But the one that really struck me, again, when the movie first came out, I was out of film school, but I wasn't really, I didn't have like the, I've actually learned more about analyzing movie structure in the years since film school than I did in film school, because writing was not something.
Doing down in front, right?
Doing down in front as well. But I came out of film school not wanting to be a writer and having done the absolute minimum amount of writing just to be able to continue to move through the program, because I really didn't want to be doing that writing. So, I really wasn't much about screenwriting. But this movie, and it was really the scene we just saw, that where I started to realize the whole idea of, a really amazingly crafted movie will do setups and payoffs. Because the thing that struck me of all the setups and payoffs was Marty wants to play at the high school dance, and later he does on that very same stage. Mm-hmm. And it's like that seems so simple, but the fact
it almost seems like you'd have a it's easier to do it with a time travel movie because you're forcing yourself to think in terms of setups and payoffs.
Exactly.
It's true,
Titanic even does that. They do times in two different places and they have the
By the time Titanic came out, I realized Cameron is really doing an amazing job of like setting things up and then paying them off.
Because setup and payoff is just another way of saying cause and effect. And cause and effect is obviously very linked to the whole idea of time travel. And if you're already thinking about time travel, you're going to naturally be thinking about cause and effect.
Mike, remember going to the rally to restore sanity, the Comedy Central thingy? And everyone had, it was basically a parody of those rallies, and everyone had signs like hyperbole kills babies.
Right.
And it was just 1,000, it was 220,000 people in the National Mall.
Can I just say, good job, whoever you are.
And all those different things, and everyone had signs, and some of them were actually like people were really taking it seriously and doing political signs, but everyone else was just kind of goofing around. And there was an entire group of people that had these big old printouts on sticks that said Save the Clock Tower, and there was just like this band of people moving through the crowd with Save the Clock Tower ads.
Awesome.
That was a
fun day.
That's it. That's very interesting. I find
you can see video of that on the forum. Went there with Jeffrey Harrell from the Diff forums.
That in the last 30 years, no one's bothered to be like, let's get that moving again. It's not that expensive. What, a couple grand? It's fine.
Yeah, like the city doesn't have like a pension fund that they can dip into just a little bit.
But
I mean, it's the 80s. Tax cuts for everybody. Come on.
It always struck me that Hill Valley is just not a very happening town.
Right.
It's like there's no. They never talk about, maybe Hill Valley is a steel mill that closed down or something like that, but just the implication I always got was that Hill Valley's kind of like,
this is like 5 minutes away. The power lines that you can see from our house are those same power lines.
Now, what's interesting, and I want to have this conversation with you guys, because this is basically just going to be a commentary of hypotheticals, but it's an A and B question.
Would shoot the child and eat the dog.
Okay.
That's always your answer.
Did they buy this house because it was in Back to the Future? Assuming not. B, what did the realtor tell them? Is it like one of those things where they have to tell you someone died in this house?
Look, there's going to be weirdos
four times a week
in your house.
Some white boys with beards are going to come by and
ring the doorbell.
They're going to do a slow ride pass with a cell phone camera. I really do wonder what their knowledge of that is and what their feelings on it are. In fact, we probably could have arranged to call them and find out.
Well, I was just going to say we should have just gone up and knocked on the door and asked them.
Yeah, we should have gone
and
knocked on the door.
Do you remember when we went to one of the houses in Pasadena, there was somebody on the porch? Do you remember that?
Yeah.
And so we were kind of like, we don't want to look too creepy.
Yeah, we went to George McFly's house is the really cool one with this awesome balcony, and they walk behind the clothesline of that house. On the porch, we're like driving by, and on that street where that house is, it's literally opposite of Biff's grandma's house and Lorraine's house.
Like Lorraine's house is like three doors down or something.
They're all on the same street. They're all within like two houses of each other on either side of the street. And we're just like taking pictures of all these things. And then we wanted to take a picture of 1955 George's house, and there's like this lady on the porch. It's like looking out, maybe. I don't know. Like, none of you kids.
Well, the greatest example of that, probably, unless there's a better one that I'm not aware of in history, is, and I know about this because I just recently borrowed your Space DVDs, but in the Spaced Making of documentary, which is like a retrospective documentary, the Spaced TV series starring Simon Pegg, where they did a years later retrospective where they went back to the house that served as the exterior. The actors went back to the house, and they're walking around the outside of the house. And while they are making that documentary, two Spaced fans show up on the street and start taking pictures of the house, at which point, in character, the actors go running out going, hey, who, Who are you taking pictures of our house? What are you doing?
That's awesome.
That would blow my fucking mind.
It's on your space DVD. You haven't seen it?
I need to see that.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
But it's like literally, it's like the look on these guys' faces when, you know, they're taking pictures of the house.
When their fourth wall crumbles in front of them.
And then the
it's all real.
Yeah.
I knew it. I knew it.
That actually reminds me. I just watched over the Thanksgiving break. I just watched the new modern day BBC Sherlock Holmes, which I highly recommend. It's amazing. But they couldn't shoot on the modern 221 Baker Street because the actual 221 Baker Street in London is just covered in Sherlock Holmes memorabilia at this point. So it just doesn't work.
That I'm reminded of. I heard one of the. I think it was Bob Saget because he still hangs out with all like the Full House guys.
The car crash story.
No, yeah. I wasn't going to tell the car crash story. He's just got a story where he's like he'll be out, you know, with like John Stamos. They'll just be hanging out, and it's like they'll like go to the bathroom or something, and some kid will come in, and they're like, "I'm pretty sure." So they'll just start talking in character, like, "I'm really worried about DJ. I think she's having trouble at college," and just kind of like blow this kid's mind, like every time they get a chance.
Trey, how is this old age makeup working for you?
Honestly, Brian, what is it you see in Leah Thompson? Because this kind of for
did you see the cake she made that looks so delicious?
Oh, okay, fair enough.
No,
so all you want in a woman is good old age makeup and a cake,
and to look good in the dress she wears to the under the sea dance.
True, that's true.
Oh my God, this
Crispin
guy.
Glover is a weirdo, but he can really bring a character.
There's no one who says different about Crispin Glover.
I just found this out recently. If I can bring it down for a second, the sister, underrated. She ended up
Sperber.
She died a little while back. Breast cancer.
Had a big sitcom. She was the co-star on Bosom Buddies with Tom Hanks and that other guy who didn't become Tom Hanks.
I can't tell if it's the 80s or not. Yep. With the shoulder pads, and also she seems like a nice person, but she also seems to be like the God had an idea and he built a jaw and he's like, I need a face to go with this jaw.
she had a whole run as sitcoms and things like that. Yeah, she was, you know, it's kind of like okay, she's this person, but when the movie came out, it's kind of like, yeah, that's kind of who you would cast. You'd probably cast her because she plays those roles.
Yeah.
I haven't seen this movie on a large screen in quite some time. I'm kind of getting freaked out by, of all things, the Diet Pepsi can. Because I'm like, wow, that's what they used to look like, the Diet Pepsi can.
I love those that pop off.
Trey, you're a time traveler.
I totally am.
Just forward and linear.
I'm here to tell you it's going to get worse.
the other thing is we went to see the Back to the Future. Okay. My and Brian's individual stated objective.
Hollywood is awesome. Second of all.
Quentin Tarantino owns a revival movie theater called the New Bev.
Yes.
Which is the New Beverly, which is basically a little room with a screen, and they play fucking amazing old movies all the time. And sometimes, like, it's almost hipstery, film hipstery, to, like, they'll do, like, a little opening in the New Bev, and they'll do a Q&A there. And it's a really fucking cool theater. And if you're in L.A., find out what's going on at the New Bev and watch a movie there. It doesn't matter what it is. Doesn't matter if you care. Just go and once
they're
experience
doing
that.
Metropolis and Battleship Potemkin tonight, and I want to be there, and I'm not.
Oh, wow. Sorry.
Anyway.
we did this for you, chat room.
So we went to see – our stated objective was to see Back to the Future trilogy at New Bev.
They were doing a triple feature. They were doing all three.
And I was like, I'm in, and I love I made it like halfway through Back to the Future 2, and I was like, I'm tired. I'm going home. But
I made it all the way through.
But what was cool was in addition to having like the world's best replica of the DeLorean. Not like, oh, the outside looked exactly like it. No, like, they didn't have a DeLorean this detailed in the movie. They had, like, six different cars. This was a fucking hero DeLorean, and everything was exactly right. He built up the flux capacitor. He built up the little digital screen, the readout. It had it was pre-Mr. Fusion. It was the actual plutonium thing in the back. And we're all, like, all these, like, kind of respectful guys just going, and the actual license plate was out of time. And it was probably a fake license plate he just puts up once he parks it there, but whatever. And we're all just kind of, like, standing back, like two steps back with our arms behind our backs, just kind of going, fuck, that's amazing. That's cool. And he had, like, one of the gull wings open on the curb side, so you can see, and he had like a plutonium hat and everything like that, right? And we're just kind of all standing, and this little 6-year-old kid.
He had the flyer, too. He had the Save the Clock Tower flyer.
It was retarded. It was like 300 grand worth of a project. Just this amazing, perfect DeLorean. And we're all standing back being respectful, and this little fucking kid walks up to the back, and on the back of the thingy, if you recall from the beginning of this movie, we're about to see it, there's a plutonium canister in a bigger glass thingy. So he spins it around, and then the canister just drops into the thing. And we're all like standing back being all respectful. This little kid just walks up like an asshole, picks up the plutonium canister out of the passenger seat.
He did ask, hey, can I put the rod in the back of the thing? And the guy's like,
oh, he
sure.
Did? I didn't know that. The story's better without that. Anyway, but he walks up, and all I see is he walks up into the passenger's thing, kind of like leans on the chair, picks up the thing, he just goes to the back of the car, and every guy in the crowd who apparently didn't see that happen, we're all like just going, dude, I want to see where this is going.
Yeah.
And he puts it on the thing, and he spins it, Thung, and we all went, whoa!
on this fake...
That's some detail!
On this fake replica, some guy made himself DeLorean. Yeah. The
you
detail
can actually
up
drop
to,
the
up well, to and including
and that,
the,
that happens very often when people recreate props for the movie. They will actually they recreate have, more than the prop itself was ever really capable of doing.
Right.
Yeah.
By the way, one of the talking about things that don't make sense is like that was a great entrance for the DeLorean. I understand it filmically. What the fuck was going on there?
Yeah.
It was full of smoke. He's in there's no way he can get out of the DeLorean when he's in the truck. Why is he in the truck, in the DeLorean,
and
full
how did
of
he
smoke
get in there in the first
to begin
place?
With? I don't understand. Apparently there's some way to climb into the DeLorean, but never mind. Anyway,
but it's very dramatic
and
cool.
And by the way, we just passed the line where he says, this is temporal experiment number one. Okay, temporal experiment number one, presumably the first temporal experiment. And so in a few minutes, he and the underage child he's brought along with him are going to stand in front of this car that is going to barrel at them at almost 90 miles an hour.
Well, no one ever said Doc says, was completely, you
if
know,
this
all
thing
there.
Does what I think it's going to do, you're going to see some serious shit. If it doesn't,
we're going to die.
You're going to be some serious shit. Yeah. Now, this is probably the best opportunity we're going to have to talk about what we, down in front, have come to call the magic bean.
Yeah.
Sort of based on what Blake Snyder, the screenwriting guru, referred to as double mumbo jumbo.
There's also a great tone conversation to have right about this section, but go ahead.
It is true, and it kind of deals with the magic bean. And this is one of the more interesting examples of the magic bean. The magic bean being our version of, you know, and it comes from Jack and the Beanstalk, where it's like, it's the magic beans. They grow a beanstalk that grows in the clouds. How does that happen? Shut up.
Yeah, they just
That doesn't matter. The story is about what happens when he climbs the beanstalk. The DeLorean is the magic bean of this movie, because obviously
there
wouldn't be a story. The story would not happen without this, you know, DeLorean doing what it does. But the weird thing about how a magic bean is, you know, as why does the DeLorean have to go 88?
Yeah. Just because.
Yeah.
And people have put that question to Bob Gale and Bob Zemeckis. It doesn't matter. It sounded good.
It made the story exciting.
Because 88 is neo-Nazi stuff, because
exactly.
H is the eighth letter of the alphabet, and then 8-8 is HH, and HH is Hail Hitler.
What does the flux capacitor really do?
And it's
what
actually 88.8, specifically.
And
is it really? In the movie?
I believe so, yes.
Yeah. What is 1.20?
I might be wrong.
What does 1.21 gigawatts do? And by the way, anyone who thinks gigawatts is spelled J-I-G-G-O, you're wrong.
Or pronounced gigawatt.
I'm pretty sure it's
a gigawatt.
It's gigawatt in the script. I'm pretty sure it is.
Yeah, I think that's because they were spelling it phonetically, but the actual word is G-I-G-A watts, and it's an actual measurement.
If you want to see an amazing reenactment of the scene, go to twitvid.com/videos/Brian Finifter.
I think the idea was that gigawatt is way above a gigawatt. Like, it's just so much fucking...
No, because it's... I think they just didn't know how
to spell
gigawatt.
I think it was gigawatt. Right. I think he wrote gigawatt, and Christopher Lloyd said gigawatt.
No, I'm pretty sure, like I said, in the script, I think it says G-I-G-O, gigawatt.
I've seen spelling errors in scripts before, too.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Anyway,
so they talk about, I think it's in the behind the scenes, in the director's commentary of this. They talk about doing the first test screening of this, and specifically this moment, the audience, you know, when you go to a test screening, when you sign up as just random Joe Schmo to go see the movie that's coming out in 3 months for a test screening in Woodland Hills, you don't know anything about it other than the little blurb they give you. And so the people that were watching the test screening of Back to the Future in 1984, 85, whatever it was, didn't know what this movie was. And so when they saw the dog in the car and the car disappear in flames.
It was like killing the cat.
It was a kicking the dog, killing the cat moment.
Like, what is this movie?
Did they just kill a dog? And the audience had this very palpable sense of like, wait, fuck this movie. And it's not until the dog comes back and the moment goes, you know, oh, the dog is fine. It's just a minute back in time, blah, blah, blah. And they talk about the very palpable sense that the audience had of like, oh, okay, this is what the movie is. Now I'm on board, and everything being okay after that point. But
was that a reshoot just then? Because he had a scene where he's like, you just fucking killed the dog. He's like, he's fine. He just traveled.
No, maybe. I don't think it's
it's in the documentary on this disc. Zemeckis just talks about, again, it's the fact that they're having that conversation was just happened to be explaining exactly what the audience was feeling at that time. He said they felt very fortunate about that. But yeah, the idea of, you know, the audience hadn't seen Back to the Future yet.
Right.
So they literally, like, did the car just explode? Did it melt? What the hell just happened? And there is the issue that you want, and the reason it was a concern, is you don't want the audience to be so thrown out of the movie. You know, I can see how you could be so thrown out of the movie, you're not hearing the conversation that's happening right before your eyes explaining what you're so concerned about.
Exactly, yeah.
One of the other cool things about that NUBEV screening was that they brought some actors out, and it was Chris Lloyd, and it was the guy who played George McFly in
Back to the Future 2.
Well, did you have more to that story? Well,
I took a picture with Christopher Lloyd, and then immediately my phone said it didn't exist, and then Christopher Lloyd was walking away, and I felt really bad about it, and then like 3 months went by, and I was just like, I don't have a picture of Christopher Lloyd, and then one day my phone just suddenly had a picture of me and Christopher Lloyd in it, and I put that on Facebook, and it was the best story ever.
Okay. Anyway, it goes back to what we were talking about, I think it's Iron Man 2, where how tone is the most important thing that a director...
In the chat room! They're still talking from when we were recording with the chat room
they
going.
They don't know we're recording
they
right
don't
now,
record,
by the way.
And Mr. Perfect in the chat room just said, just don't mention Back to the Future.
This was for you, Mr. Perfect.
This
awesome.
One's for you.
That's fantastic.
I've lost what I was going to say.
What I was
actors,
going to say...
George McFly.
No, before
you,
that.
You, okay. You guys brought that's up the new Bev and Soul by Tarantino like that. Before... Just to throw this out there, I don't expect it to start a conversation or anything, but we were talking about how this is like a bunch of little collections of pop culture. Trey was saying that and stuff like that. And as soon as he said that, I was like, what if Quentin Tarantino made Back to the Future?
Well, God. I think it would get weighed down in the pop culture references rather than just having them be.
It could be.
No, but a Quentin Tarantino like time travel movie.
That could be pretty badass.
Honestly, I want to see Quentin Tarantino tackle every genre that exists. Like, I really do want to see Quentin Tarantino do.
I
a
would
science
like to. Here we go. Here's the magic bean. Magic beans do things. Magic things.
I would like to see
Shield Eyes
Chris
from
Nolan's
Light.
Back to the Future.
No, okay. Yeah.
He did the Prestige. So he did steampunk Back to the Future.
There you go. Now again, another thing that might be lost on. I mean, are you guys aware of the ironic humor of the fact that this is a DeLorean?
Because the DeLorean was a piece of shit.
I am now.
Not that the DeLorean was a piece of shit, but that the guy who... Mr. DeLorean was a piece of shit.
Yeah, he got indicted on coke charges.
Exactly. His car company was failing, and he, as comedians at the time pointed out, he's like, he was trying to, like... He got busted trying to, like, carry 70 pounds of cocaine through LAX. It's like, you're not allowed that much in luggage anyway.
Yeah, 70 pounds is too much.
It's like, if you had that much anything, they would stop you.
On the subject of DeLoreans, and you can't even do that, I worked on a show for the Speed Network it was like a kind of a Top Gear kind of show, and we did a test with a DeLorean against like a Camry. And it was really sad because this guy had like a fucking amazing cleaned up non-Back to the Future, just DeLorean. He'd made it run better. He'd restored everything. It was all working parts from the factory from 15, 20 years ago, built up a brand new DeLorean, right? Basically out of what he had. And he was like, all right, we're going to see how fast we can get this thing to 88. The DeLorean literally can't go 90 miles per hour.
It can't.
It literally cannot go that fast.
That's why they have the digital speedometer readout on the dashboard, because the actual speedometer does not go to 88.
Which they didn't know when they were writing it. They weren't
This is the thing the kid did, and it blew our fucking minds. Look at it. It just goes thunk, and it did the exact same thing on the car. What's wrong with that guy?
By the way, the in terms of setup and payoff, even like the jokes are set up and paid like in long distances. Like that's how a joke works, is set up and payoff. But
a
like
brick
over,
joke. That's what a brick joke is.
Over long periods of time, because it's he literally Marty says, you know, he's like, did you rip that off? You don't just go into a store and buy plutonium. And then when he has that conversation with Doc later, 50s Doc, 50s Doc goes, I'm sure in the future you can just walk into a store and buy plutonium. But that's not how it works in the 50s.
I also just want to point, the real value in any movie is in being able to watch it over and over again and watch it multiple times and see new things. And just now I've noticed something that I've never seen before, that on his truck it says, you know, Doc Emmett Brown, 24-hour science services. I've never noticed the 24-hour science services before. That's so great. Anyway,
actually become a door-to-door scientist.
Yeah, basically.
Do you need any science?
Do you need if you need science at 3 a.m.?
Yeah, there's one man to call.
Doc Brown is your man.
You know what? I buy that too. Just look at him. You're like, he's the guy who wants you to call him because you need science.
We were driving through Century City a while back, which is where like Nakatomi Tower and all that stuff is. It's like it's the big businessy part of Hollywood. And it was me and Chloe in the car and someone that we had just picked up from the airport. And we're going down the road, and it's like this big 25-lane road. Not a highway, just this huge-ass fucking wide road going through all those buildings. And there's a guy on a bike with goggles and a lab coat on.
Awesome.
If I recall correctly, he was even wearing sandals, but I might be taking that out of Fish Guys. But he's riding a bike down the street in a lab coat. And Chloe rolls down the window and goes, do you do bike science? I was like, ah! And I drove off because I was too worried that his answer was going to be, yes.
That's Hollywood.
And then wave a magic wand and things would explode.
So what I was gonna do bike science?
What I was going to say earlier with regards to the whole test audience thing, it's, you know, we tend to like think of and disparage test audiences as the scourge of true artistry and filmmaking. But it has to be said in their defense that sometimes they get it right, and they get things right that you would not get right otherwise as a filmmaker. I just worked on a movie where I got to go to the preview screening of it. And looking at all the comments after the fact, it was like everything, with the exception of what the movie was, like people are like, oh, it's too this and it's too that. I was like, well, okay, that's just what the movie is. So if you're not on board, you're not on board. But like the actual story aspect of what the notes were, like people are like, yeah, I was confused by this character. She just seemed to be, you know, I didn't know who she was. I couldn't tell her apart from the other. And these two characters, they didn't really have an end to their subplot. You know, what was that about? And they were absolutely right. And the defense has to be made. Like, sometimes, you know, sometimes you get a Scott Pilgrim thing where, you know, they go, no, he has to end up with Ramona. I go, no, 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 no. But sometimes there is value in the focus group audience where they tell you, I don't understand what happened with these two characters or where the payoff to this setup was.
Right.
And there is value in that.
I will also point out, we were talking about the gag of the DeLorean. It's also worth noting that was along the path of development, and this movie almost invented the term nuking the fridge.
Yes. True.
Because the original time machine was going to be a refrigerator that Doc Brown had tweaked and
had
stuff like that.
Yeah.
And the plot at the end, as opposed to the lightning striking the clock tower and all of that, was they were going to sneak the refrigerator onto the ground zero location of an atomic bomb test. Mm-hmm. So they were literally going to nuke the fridge, and that was the climax of the movie. I don't even know how that movie works.
Steven Spielberg said, "That's retarded. I would never do anything
like that." I would never do something like that.
Yeah, you got to rewrite that, guys.
Right, George? And George went, what?
If my name is going to be on this, you have to make it something better. Yeah. And they did, and then.
Well, George was too busy with the Star Wars holiday special at that point.
Do you guys remember those little, I'm sure Trey does, those little standing in like the mall parking lot photo developing kiosks?
Yeah, little photo shops.
Yeah, I remember them.
Those were all over the place.
Yeah.
Oh, that industry.
Back when developing film was a thing.
There's also on Highland or Vine, there is a freestanding kiosk that sells cigarettes.
Oh.
Just in a parking lot.
Just
drive through here. We'll give you some cigarettes.
A few of those are done up places
now. That just sells milk. That there's still like, you know, milk stores. There's one in Tahunga.
Okay, so now we're in the past.
Hey, we've had a plot turning point, and now we are in Act 2.
By the way, it should be noted that you can, in fact, buy a DeLorean today if you want to. They've started remaking them.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Well, you can also there are people who specialize in building all this stuff.
Restoring
you need to check it out and make
there's
it.
There's
back
a guy
the
here in North Hollywood named George Barris who does all those old cars. And in fact, he was the guy. I don't think he did the DeLorean, but he did Munster car, and he did Knight Rider and all those other things. And
the Adam West Batmobile.
Yeah, he did. That's exactly right. Yeah, and the other cool thing about this, talking about Old Man Peabody, used to make pine trees. He used to grow a pine tree. I had this weird idea about cloning pine trees. When you see the mall in the beginning, it's the Twin Pine Mall. Yeah. He knocks down a tree. You son of a bitch!
Kill my pine.
Later, it's the Lone Pine Mall.
Yes,
and that's the biggest mistake in the movie.
Why is that?
Because when he's standing in front of the sign that says Lone Pine Mall, he's watching himself go back in time.
Wow. Well, here's the thing.
Then it screws you up.
No. This is a great segue into
Mike's
thing. Go ahead,
Mike. This is my thing about the time travel. A lot of people.
No, it's my thing.
When we talk about time travel movies, you talk about time travel and you're like, well, that didn't make sense. It's like, well, time travel movies never make sense. It's like, I think most people, just their primary experience with time travel movies is Back to the Future and that series, in which the time travel makes no sense. And the main issue with Back to the Future time travel is that it doesn't make a decision. It can't. It just doesn't bother to make a decision between whether it's an open timeline or a closed timeline.
Right, right. There's two distinct time travel type stories. There's the alternate universe. You go back and you change something that creates a separate alternate universe that is distinct from the one that you started with.
Back to the Future 2, it sounds like that's what they're dealing with.
That's what Doc Brown diagrams on the chalkboard. There's that, and there's also the closed loop predestination grandfather paradox.
Right.
If I go back in time,
if you go back and kill your grandfather, you were already dead at the beginning.
Exactly. Yeah. And then, so therefore, you can't go back in time because you were never born.
Yeah. Well, you can't change anything. You can only go back, and anything you do has already moved forward.
Which is the way Lost takes it.
If Back to the Future were a closed timeline, then his parents would be cool at the beginning of the movie. He'd go back and discover they sucked, and he would slowly discover how that happened.
And at times, Back to the Future is that way. And at times, Terminator is that way, and the other way. Star Trek is one way,
I think Lone Pine, Twin Pines is a mistake as they present it, because if they wanted to be a cleaner sort of, okay, here's the rules, is he should have run up to a sign that said Twin Pines, seen himself go back in time, and run away from a sign that said Lone Pine.
That could have been interesting.
Because then you're talking, because the question the movie is giving you is like, okay, that Marty that Marty we're watching drive away lived his whole life with cool, well-adjusted parents.
Right.
So what was the story and what's going on
in this world? Well, that's
the
whole thing. It's like the Marty that's here now. There was a whole article on Cracked where it's like how the end of Back to the Future is secretly horrifying, because it's like he's now living in a world where like he has memories that no one else has any memories of, and he's got this whole lifetime that it's like how long is it going to be before they commit him to an asylum because he's remembering this entire life that never happened.
And is the movie trying to? I doubt they were doing this on purpose, but they're saying that there's a closed loop, but it's a double loop. Where it's like that Marty's going to go back and wreck everything and come back to the ruined. So that way, now it's a closed loop, except it repeats two different ways.
That could be it, because in Back to the Future 2, it establishes, it very clearly makes the thing of these are two alternate timelines. And first of all, the idea that you can get back to the original timeline.
You can go back to the point of divergence.
One of the big things about Back to the Future time travel is it does not take into account the butterfly effect at all. The butterfly effect is not part of it. It's just gross changes. Like this guy,
you just have to accept that his parents lived an entirely different life and bought the same house.
Yeah, these guys, it's totally that. It's the parents either suck or they're cool. Like just binary changes. It's not because if you really wanted to pursue it, it's like what are really the odds that these parents had this completely different way of getting together, and yet
they had sex at the exact same moment,
sperm and egg, sperm. three times
exactly. So it's like no, but that's the way Back to the Future time travel works. Right. It's like just broad changes and stuff like that.
Hey, if you have sex on Valentine's Day,
But this what I wanted to get into, I think one of the reason that this movie works, even though we can talk about that and we can continue bringing that up, I mean, when the picture shows up, I don't even remember. Has the picture even been established yet?
Picture?
No.
Yeah. Oh, no,
I think that comes in late.
Yeah, the picture, that's completely the ticking
clock.
Yeah,
he shows that to Doc later. Okay. Yeah.
When the picture comes up, we can totally talk about
it. I know this movie so well.
And the picture is one of the lamest things.
Yeah.
And it's just one of those visual representations you have to have.
But it's
of a ticking clock.
It's so great as a ticking clock that you don't even think about it. But we'll talk about it when we get there.
This doesn't make any sense. But, it's like, hey.
That aspect is, there's this other aspect to the time travel of, it's not unique to Back to the Future, but Back to the Future is the clearest example of it. That there's this sort of like delayed wave of effect of the time. You know, when he alters the timeline,
Millennium went that way too. That when you go back and change something, there's a time quake ripples upward.
Yeah.
You know, and if it's so devastating, it's destructive, and you know things will completely be obliterated.
But there is it's not instantaneous. There is a certain amount of delay that operates by some physical rules that we don't know where it's. I change the future. I change the past, and then 5 seconds later, the future alters.
Well, that's the only way to make sense of Back to the Future 2, where future Biff goes back, changes the past, and yet manages to get back to the original timeline, so Marty and Doc can get the car again. But
which nobody in this room is a temporal physicist, so we don't know.
Yeah, maybe it could work that way. But the more important thing, and the thing I wanted to get to, and was referencing before,
he rips the page right out of the phone book.
People do that all the time.
That's
in movies.
A kick the dog movie. Kick the dog moment for me. I just can't get on board with that kind of wanton civil destruction.
But
I just like the line where it's a perfectly logical line, but it's also ridiculous. The fact that he looks him up and goes, "Great, you're alive." Well, of course he's alive. It's 30 years ago.
Yeah,
but he still thinks it's a dream. Yeah. So he's still convincing himself that it's real versus not a dream.
But the important thing in what we were talking about before we started recording this is. A lot of those things don't make sense in terms of the plot if you really sit down and think about them. But because this movie makes an emotional kind of sense,
and that's the distinction.
It has an emotional logic to it, as much of an oxymoron as that term may be. No, you don't care. While you're watching it, you're like, this makes sense. I'm watching people behaving like people, and there are people that I like watching behave like people, and that's what matters. I just want to see them succeed in whatever they're trying to do. So the fact that Marty is a character that we like, the fact that Doc is a character that we like, that gets us past all of the logic problems because we're willing to go along with it to watch them tell their story.
And the fact that everything that everybody does in the cause and effect relationship between their relationships, you know, Marty does A, so therefore Doc does B, and that cause and effect always makes sense for the most part. That's the emotional logic of this story and of any story. And that, I think, goes back to the idea that the invention of stories, the idea of stories and the sociological function they serve is to go,
ooh, he's going.
I'm going there.
Oh, boy.
Is the idea that they're, you know, the function of a story as a tool that human beings created is to go, okay, this is how human beings should or should not behave. Here you go as an example of that. And so that's why stories were invented, however many tens or hundreds of thousands of years ago. So that's like the functional necessity of stories. And as long as that works, then you can add whatever crazy magic bean stuff you want around it. But that goes back to saying, you know, as long as the characters are human and are doing human things and are behaving in a human way, then it makes sense. Then we buy into it.
Right. What am
and
I
so
supposed to learn about?
It doesn't matter if they're on an alien planet or using a time machine. Are the people that I'm watching, are they human beings, and are they behaving like human beings? And as long as they are doing that, then I totally buy what
yeah,
is happening.
Yeah, and am I learning something about being a human being
exactly.
from telling that
and
story?
How to relate to other human beings.
Right, and a lot of stories nowadays, the reason that we have the arguments about, well, this doesn't make sense and blah, 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 even though it might not be even nearly as egregious as Back to the Future in some cases, is because they've already lost us on the aspect of there is no human being in the story that I'm engaging
yeah.
with or care about. So I'm purely analyzing it for the
right
the,
because
you
I'm
know,
not engaged
the
in the actual behavior of it. I think that's the great. I think we're in a dark age of cinema, and the fact that most of the mass media that is out right now does not even approach that level of.
Well, just
comprehension
just yeah.
of confidence. Wow, I'm so drunk I can't even remember.
Brian, champagne.
Right. I just noticed something, Brian.
Yeah.
He's parked right inside of his house.
Yeah.
He's peeping at Lorraine's house from across the street. So even in the universe, they live across the street from each other. I'd never put that together.
Is that true, or is he
yeah,
just
no, that's
parked
true.
Across
he's
the street?
Parked, that's his house in the background. That's yeah. George McFly's house. He's looking into... I think he's looking into Lorraine. Yeah, it would be Lorraine's house over there. So this in the universe.
No. I don't think that is Lorraine's house.
I don't think it is. We
well,
never
then why is
that,
her dad driving right there?
That's a random.
He's driving past.
I don't know. Anyway, whatever.
Yeah.
So
that's a so,
why
that's
is
some
taking
random
her
girl.
Clothes off and someone else. Oh, okay.
That's some random girl's.
Because
house.
You don't see that it's Lorraine.
You don't.
You see a girl. He's just.
I don't think the point of it is that it is Lorraine. It's
no, but he yells at the mom right there. There it is.
That's true. Yeah,
it's across the street from the house.
It's Lorraine.
Okay. Fair enough.
Anyway,
well, he was always into Lorraine. There's a,
and then
that's
he,
cool.
But then he runs away. I mean, if he's the kid literally across the street, they know who he is. You know,
yeah,
whether
yeah.
or not she hangs out with him at school.
Yeah, I don't think that's he is. Although,
that
also,
was his house and her house.
Also, in terms of a storytelling thing, it's interesting to think about this movie in terms of you can make an argument that Marty is not actually the protagonist. He's the main character, but the protagonist is actually George.
Yeah.
The person with the arc is George. Marty is the mentor character. We're
true.
Watching the Obi-Wan.
Marty
story.
Doesn't change.
Marty
is the Obi-Wan.
Marty doesn't really
yeah.
change.
Mike, can you just shut the fuck up while my mind is still in one piece?
Marty doesn't change. Marty wants things to be the same. He is here to make things, you know, come back to normal again.
Yeah, he wants to make
Marty's a Republican.
He wants to make things right, but he screws them up before. Well, he screwed them up as of this moment. He's trying to fix them.
Here's where it's going
to
go very, very wrong.
He winds up fixing them better than when he left.
It is funny how just this moment was, you know, that they were literally concerned about this aspect of the movie. This whole, you know,
this
the
is
whole
a pretty
Freudian aspect.
Mom incest
they should
thing.
Be.
It's weird. It's pretty. It's kind of interesting to contemplate that they got away with it, you know, and were so successful with it.
To this day, it blows my mind the fact that this is a mainstream. You know, I don't know if they were thinking in terms of this is a kids movie, but obviously it was and it is. This is a kids movie, and this is serious Freudian shit going on.
Kids get it. They're totally. No.
I think kids get it on the humor level.
Yeah.
I don't think they get it on that's gross level.
It's
older people who are like,
there was a wonderful college. Did you guys see the College Humor video? Not the Cracked video, the College Humor one where it's Marty is having sex with his mom in the car, and then he has to go back and send another hymn to stop them from having sex, but he just joins in, and it's like,
and it just goes from twosome to threesome to foursome to fivesome.
Oh, yeah. Wow. And you thought Kyle Reese had a hard decision to make. Damn.
But it's also interesting to note that I think one of the reasons this movie is so successful is that it can connect on so many levels. It's connecting on the level of it's just funny. They're being silly, and there's Doc is very silly, so you can connect when you're
a great
kid.
Pratfall right there.
Yeah,
it's great. Now it's like that every morning at Mike's house.
Aww.
Oh,
okay,
yeah.
But hang on. And when, we made it 40, 45 minutes almost.
That's
45 minutes almost without making a Parkinson's joke.
We need to get
okay?
it out of the way. There, it's done.
Oh, we were talking about him. I thought you were talking about me. I'm like, I don't get the joke. I fall over when I'm putting my pants
on. Not you, Mike. Actually, pardon me. I've been tainted by working with Barry Bostwick because Barry Bostwick was on Spin City with Michael J. Fox for however many years. And apparently, he always calls, whenever he talks about him, he refers to, apparently, if you know Michael J. Fox, he's called Mike. I feel like I know Michael J. Fox.
I thought you were going to go with, like, apparently if you know Michael J. Fox, you can make fun of Parkinson's all day
all
long.
Day long.
I think if you literally do, I think you literally can. Yeah. I'm not actually at that level, but it was interesting that Barry always refers to him as Mike. Mike Fox. Ah. That's what apparently if you're on the inside, that's what you call him.
The other thing about if you're a kid, you just appreciate that Doc Brown is silly and there's, you know, actiony.
He does crazy faces.
Yeah. You know, as a teenager, you can appreciate the idea of, I don't want to grow up to be my parents, but it's visualized in the sense of, I don't want my parents to grow up to be my parents either, you know, so you can actually fix it. And if you're an adult, you can look and go, this is about kind of second chances, being like, oh, those mistakes I made when I was young, like, I can undo them.
If I could go back to high school
and tell myself what I know now.
And don't be an idiot.
Yeah, and this movie is all about that.
Yeah.
And the thing is, so this movie is about Marty fixing his family. The next movie is also kind of about Marty fixing his family. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the problem that people have with the third movie.
The third one?
I've never super, like, disliked the third one because I grew up with it. I liked it.
I like it a lot.
But I see people's objection, or they may not be able to articulate it, but I think people's objection to it may be, it doesn't feel like the same story because it's not about Marty's family. It's not about Marty saving his family. You can make an argument that Doc kind of is his family, but it's not about fixing the future. Well, something has not broken in the past.
It's not as neat as 1 and 2 are. I mean, in the sense that
I mean, the
climax of Back to the Future 2 is one of the greatest climaxes of all time, and recreating that entire setup and set piece from the first one and adding another dimension to it. Honestly, I mean,
although to be fair, if you actually think about it, it's not like he changed anything. He just walked through the set piece from the original one. It's not like he interacted with it other than
He wasn't changing any of the stakes that we knew existed from the first one. All the stakes that existed in the second one were only added in the second one. Because they didn't, when they made the first one, they didn't know the second one was going to come, obviously.
They made the two and the three simultaneously.
Honestly, and in case we never do the second and third, I'll go ahead and blow my load about them right now, in the sense that I think it would have been better structured had they made the Old West number two and the climax of the entire trilogy had been going back to the Enchantment Under the Sea dance.
That probably would have been good. Yeah.
I think, you know, structurally, if you're looking at all three movies as one story, that would have worked better.
Because part of the problem is the Old West has nothing to do with the other stuff.
Right.
If Marty hadn't succeeded, it's like, well, Doc gets shot and that sucks, but it's 1955. He was going to be dead by now anyway.
Right.
You know, it's like you're not really saving anything other than we like Doc, so let's go back and save him.
Right.
Like, it doesn't have anything to do with Marty's family. They do show up, which, by the way, why do they look like Marty and Lorraine when they would be his paternal ancestors? But anyway...
By that point, you have to accept that this universe is like got those kind of loops in it.
Yeah.
I mean, the movie even does that. Even hangs a lantern on the old idea.
So this is Teague. What's the actual name of this place? Bramble House.
The something house. Yeah.
Bramble Planter Platter. Something.
It's a historical
Bramble or Bramble House.
It's a historical
house.
classic in Pasadena.
Beautiful, beautiful
place.
It's a
tourist attraction. You can actually do tours and stuff. No one actually lives there. But the movie by this point, at some point, they you know Doc says. You know, because Marty asks the question like he often does, well, why is this day always the day where all this shit's happening? And he goes, well, because of the temporal thing, or it could just be a big coincidence. I mean, they just go, look, just if you're not on board now, come on. Where are these movies?
The garage of the house of this great big, which is like an architectural.
Gamble House is what it's
called? Gamble House, that's what it is.
Yeah.
Which is like an architectural tourist attraction at this point. The garage of it is a separate standalone building, and that's the only thing that's is still standing in the Back to the Future universe of Doc.
So they just recreated that next to a Burger King.
And in real life, the standalone garage now is the bookstore, which is just blows my mind for some reason, and I can't even articulate why.
That a garage turns into a bookstore?
Well, it's just that, like, I was standing. We were standing in the bookstore gift shop of this place, and that's Doc Brown's. Yeah.
This is where Doc made the time machine.
This is where he built the time machine.
Why don't you appreciate
the future? This is where
you
want to sell me a subscription to the Saturday Evening Post.
And if I remember right, Teague, confirm.
No, I put my butt on everything. Yeah.
To confirm or deny this, but there was no actual like Back to the Future.
Not a damn fucking thing. What? How many architecture fags are there? How many Back to the Future fags are there?
And how many Firefly flags are there? Because that's also Young River. That's
the house that her and Zac Efron hang out
River in. And River Tam's
By the way,
home.
Young Simon is Zac Efron.
Yes.
I learned that
Doesn't that hurt your head?
No, I
that
just,
has been an insightful comment.
Yeah,
thank you. This down
no,
in front.
I discovered that like I was looking at IMDb for some reason, and I was like, he was young Simon. Yeah, he was. Yeah.
Oh my gosh! I'm like, where did that come from?
Could you recall? Because I had to watch the episode again, but you were just
I pulled
able
it
to,
back up in my head, and yeah. I'm like, that fucking totally was him. Oh my god!
To me, that was on the same level of great travesties as I went to the.
Say the Holocaust. Just get yourself out of this now.
The Holocaust and whatever Stalin did, but also
Pol Pot,
the Starfleet, the forefront, the building thing that they use in the composites for Starfleet Academy on Star Trek is actually the
water treatment plant.
The water treatment plant in Van Nuys, and it's a very nice Japanese garden attached to it, which plays the campus. And so I went there one time because I was kind of in that neighborhood. It's actually kind of weird by where you live, Mike. And so I went into their little like gift shop and souvenir shop.
Star Trek stuff?
Nothing. Not a goddamn Star Trek thing.
Well, if you go to the Griffith Observatory, you have to go through the tunnel from Back to the Future 2, where he's like, Biff is trying to crush him with right. the Buick. At the Griffith Observatory. Nothing but space shit. Am I right?
Whereas if you go to the castle where they shot Monty Python and the Holy Grail, they have all kinds of memorabilia.
Because they know. They know where their yeah. paycheck is coming That's from. Right. I paid $3 to park at that parking lot of that Japanese garden.
Everyone, just to...
Do you know that you're Starfleet? Just ask the guy at the gift shop.
Just to, and often they don't. That's the sad thing. Just to segue radically, but it'll make sense in a sec, possibly, is has everyone seen, if we should reference it just for anyone have, Biff's Question song on YouTube?
Yes.
Of course.
Stop asking me the question.
Yeah, so look it up, the actual actor's name.
Thomas Biff. F. Wilson.
Thomas F. Wilson. Thomas Wilson.
Who is in The Informant?
He's been a lot of He's been other
he's,
stuff.
He's all over
he,
the place.
He is kind of stuck being Biff for life, and he knows that. And
Thomas Wilson's... go to YouTube, type in Thomas Wilson's song.
Yeah. I actually got to see him perform that live, I think for like the first time. We happened to
He's
be at the Improv.
It too. He's
and
he added
was,
to it.
And he was there just like as an opener for, I think, either Patton Oswalt or Sarah Silverman or someone was there who he'd gone to see. And Thomas Wilson comes up and he sings that song. And we're all like, holy shit, man, this is the best thing that has ever happened. And then it went on the
YouTube. If friend alum Jake Lloyd opened for Tom Wilson a couple times.
If you happen to not know it, but go look it up because it's very fun. But it's a song about how for the past 30 years, people have been asking him the same questions about Back to the Future. So he wrote a song that has all the answers to
Will
it.
Will you call my friend a butthead on his answering machine?
Yes, exactly.
What does the key grip do?
I don't know.
But I saw a recent an updated version where he, you know, because once he did that song, it became a big thing on YouTube. Now of course he has to perform it regularly because now they want him to do that song every time he does a performance, so he does that. So he has been
Poor
updating
guy.
It. Yeah, I know. It's
he
like
can't,
you gotta
he
run
can't
with
not
it.
Be pigeonholed.
Anyway, I just happened to just recently see, you know, and some of his other novelty songs are great too, but I saw recently a version where it was someone in a club had recorded him doing it again. And instead of doing the same question three times as the refrain, now he actually he's packed in more questions. And one of the ones he's added is what's Michael J. Fox like? He's nice. You know, in the original version, he repeats it three times. Now he does it three different actors. So I was like, what's Michael J. Fox nice? He's nice.
Who's the nicest guy in Hollywood? Adam Sandler?
Exactly. No, it's the next line is, what's that actor's name?
Christopher Lloyd.
What's Christopher Lloyd like? Kind of quiet.
By the way, so we went to see the triple feature of Back to the Future. And
don't put me in this.
You were there. You were there. You did nothing. And Christopher Lloyd was one of the guests. He was obviously the biggest guest of it. Quietest individual of all human beings to have ever lived, past, present, and future.
Yeah.
The poor, like, New Beverly worker who was, you know, had hand them the microphones and had the little, like, mixer board off to the side. Every time somebody would ask him a question, he would, and you would just see her, like, slide up the little slider on the mixer board as far as it would go.
Yeah.
You did this with your face.
I'm not gonna say I was disappointed, because people can be whoever they are. But when I got
My Favorite Martian,
when I did My Favorite Martian, and our digital character worked almost exclusively with, you know, Christopher Lloyd. So every plate we shot was Christopher Lloyd reacting to, you know, me going, here's kind of what he's gonna do, kind of something like this. Sometimes we had a guy actually stand in to do it. But you know, I did a lot of shots with Christopher Lloyd.
I love you, Trey.
If you met Christopher Lloyd walking down the street, you don't see no Doc Brown. It's like if you go, "Hey, you're Christopher Lloyd," he goes, "I am Christopher Lloyd." He, you know, he doesn't. Talk about a guy who puts it all on screen.
Yeah.
that's Christopher Lloyd. It's amazing. It's amazing how quiet he is. I mean,
he's like your boy and grandpa.
Literally, it's like when he's not shooting, he goes over, he sits in the chair, and he's just sitting there. You might think, you know, you'll make conversation. He's not unfriendly at all. You go, "Hey, Christopher," you know, but he's just. you know, he's just, he's in whatever headspace he's in. And then you know, okay, Chris, could you, okay, stand here. Okay. And we're taking it from, okay. And action. Suddenly it's
Christopher. Then he hits you with it.
Boom. He goes, you know, he goes from zero to Christopher Lloyd.
I got some Chris Lloyd on my face.
I think
again,
my favorite bit from the I must have seen an updated version then because it was all the other actors and
what's Crispin Glover like? He's unusual.
Yeah, that was it. That was the one. What's Crispin Glover like? Unusual. Stop asking me the question.
See, here's the problem I have with the photograph is the fact that the brother is disappearing in bits.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, no, that was my thing. I was like, so there's an alternate reality
where
he has
no
just
head,
has no head,
and they take a picture of it.
Yeah, they
now,
took a picture.
Even as a kid, I was like, eh?
Yeah.
We went to this place, by the way. It's actually, incidentally, of all the places in Back to the Future, this place is covered in bars.
There's got to be, by the way,
we couldn't actually get on the grounds itself.
There's got to be some kind of trope for the idea of like changing the past because it's happened most recently in Deathly Hallows Part 1 as well.
How do you know it hasn't happened a million times?
Yeah, well, it probably has, but I'm saying I can only think of the two examples.
What if somebody went back in time and erased that trope from existence?
if someone went back in time and invented a Michael so we could have one?
So Hermione makes her parents forget that she existed, and you see that visually because she disappears from a bunch of family photos.
And it's very sad.
It's very sad, and it's very emotional. Again, the emotional logic trumping the actual logic, in a sense, because you watch it and you're like, wow, that's really impactful. But then you think about it for a second, you're like...
Did the room redecorate itself?
There's all these pictures where she disappears from, and several of them are school photos. So it's like, what do they take a picture of? Are they gonna be looking
honey,
at that?
Can we
like,
get some random pictures honey, of children in school? Sure. Yeah,
can we get some pictures of just a blank photographic backdrop? That sounds like a great, like they've got to be walking around after the amnesia hits, you know, after the obliviate spell hits, being like, what? Why do we have this picture framed? Do you remember? It's never occurred to me to question it
before.
I
knew a guy at the Dave School who didn't have any like friends or family really. He was kind of an inward guy, but he had a nice apartment because he was an inward guy and he worked his ass off. So he was, you know, he was basically like Edward Norton in the beginning of Fight Club, right? Mm-hmm. And he has a bunch of frames with nice looking, beautiful pictures of gorgeous people in them. And I'm like, oh, who's this? He's like, I don't know. It's just the picture they printed up and put in the frame.
Yeah,
the box.
It came with the frame.
It
like,
sucks.
Wow.
There's.
That's freaky.
Wow, Mike.
An interesting thing that they...
King of sound effects.
Yeah. One thing that could have been interesting if they'd done it with the picture. And again, this would not... I don't think this would necessarily improve the film. I don't think the film needs improving. But another thing they could have done with it that could have made sense is if every time he looks at the photo, like it's like that Simpsons episode where he was traveling through time and he'd come back to the future and things would be different and he'd keep going back trying to reset it. And like there was one where, you know, he was rich and it rained donuts, but he left before he found that out. And stuff like that.
The greatest Treehouse of Horror of all time.
Yeah, that's the greatest tragedy. Like I've never gotten over the fact that it's like if he had stayed for 5 more seconds, he would have been so happy. Poor Homer. But if that's what they did with the picture, like every time he looks at the picture, it's like a completely different family or it's like this totally different world where he was like, oh shit, I can't go back to that one. Yeah. I gotta keep trying. Something has gone horribly wrong.
That's kind of what the Simpsons did. Yeah.
Like a Sliders kind of aspect. Like, is this one cool?
That one looks really cool. Marty, you're not in that one. Oh shit. Yeah, I gotta.
On the subject
of
the picture.
Wait, the fence isn't squeaky. Let's move on.
On the subject of the picture, it became a thing the last year that they had not a replica. There's a props place that sells like movie props, right? And you can buy Indiana Jones' whip for $50,000 or something. They found the original made up composite picture of Eric Stoltz and his brother that's half gone.
Oh, wow.
And they sold that. I don't remember how much it sold for, but it was like, holy shit!
That's a fucking collectible.
Eric Stoltz, is that the guy from Caprica?
Yeah.
I don't know what any of those words mean, actually. I don't know what any of those. I knew is.
It's the guy from Mask.
Anyway, yeah, but we went
who does not deserve an Oscar for that, by the way.
That's right, because you couldn't see his face. But our digital character that played opposite Christopher Lloyd does.
Oh, Crispin Glover.
His dad's nuts, too.
Yeah.
Who is his dad?
His dad is...
Danny Glover?
No. So it's actually mom is the real story.
Figure that out.
Mom is the real interesting one in that crowd. What's his name? John Glover? Is that his name? He played a villain in one of the Bond movies.
John Glover sounds like a name I've heard.
No, it's not John Glover, though. That's a different actor. It's a different... it's another guy, but he played Mr. Wint and Mr. Kidd from Diamonds Are Forever, I believe. And these two, like, strangely probably gay killers who, you know, they're like secondary villains. And they're both these weird fucking guys. Crispin Glover.
Have any of you seen Willard?
No.
Yep.
Not the new one. I've seen the original. But
I mean the Crispin Glover
not
Willard.
Not the remake, no.
Okay. Don't nod, Teague. Tell us the story.
One day, I was watching Willard.
Good story.
And then I
cool
was never the same.
Why isn't Billy Zane in the crowd here?
I think he shows up in the second one, doesn't he?
No, he's in the
crowd. He's part of the
crowd. It's like,
yeah.
But there's Casey Zemoshko and the third guy. But
yeah, he's part of Biff's gang.
No, we saw him. Billy Zane is the fourth guy.
Billy Zane.
Yeah, but he's not in this scene for whatever reason.
Oh, didn't that guy ever have hair?
Casey Zemoshko, whose credit is 3D because he's the 3D glasses kid there. I actually met him when he first came to L.A. and was trying to be an actor and was going out on a bunch of auditions. And he became like a thing. This was like an early part for him. Then he became like a leading man and was in a bunch of movies. The best one of the bunch was 3 O'Clock High. If you've ever seen 3 O'Clock High, it's a great movie. Really unsung classic.
What happened to him?
I don't know what happened to him. He did a bunch of starring roles and a bunch to the point where he was already a big deal by the time Back to the Future was made. And I remember at least one review I read of Back to the Future 2 said it's so weird that they put a big actor like Casey Zemoshko in that movie and don't give him anything to do. And it's like he's being his character. Never mind. He was already. Never mind. But it's Billy Zane is the one that kind of freaks me out all the more. It's kind of like, wow, that's Billy Zane. Look at that. He's going to grow up and be in Titanic and a bunch of other movies.
Well, I mean, the real mindfuck is 5-year-old Elijah Wood in Back to the Future 2.
It's also
who is he in that?
He's the little kid that says you have to use your hands. That's a baby's toy.
Okay, that's right. Okay, yeah. There you go.
But it's also interesting.
He hasn't gotten any taller.
Yeah. The idea he's. Marty is just like at the school, and the principal or the dean or whoever he is comes up, and I only realized it just now when Biff was like, "Since you're new here, I'm going to cut you a break." I'm like, "So he just walked in and became a student, and everyone just accepted it?"
It was like, It was pre 9/11.
Yeah, you didn't have no metal detectors, no nothing.
Yeah, like that is amazing.
And I feel like in the butterfly effect, saying the words Darth Vader and Planet Vulcan would have a larger effect on the popular culture than Marty would probably
attend. I always gave that one a pass because I always figure that he actually probably wouldn't remember specifically the words.
So he would come up with, like, you know, Dark
Vader. Yeah, he said, I'm Darth Vader and I'm Ralph Nader.
Or
and,
he'd probably, you know.
The Planet Fucking.
Over the course of the next 20 years until that movie came out, he probably would have just convinced himself that was all a dream and forgotten a lot of the details.
Yeah. Well, no. I mean, because the payoff to that setup is that that's the
book.
Basis
he
for his
Match
his
Made
book
in Space.
Yeah, Match Made in Space.
Yeah. I love the fact that, but you got to be impressed by how resourceful and smart Marty is. He's like, all right, he likes sci-fi. I'm just going to go for it. And he does it. And it immediately works. He's like, Darth Vader told me to melt my brains if I didn't ask him out for the dance. And
okay,
you'd be like,
let's keep that to ourselves.
Yeah. You and me, we're going to just. I'm glad it worked, but I'm a little scared how much it worked. Yeah. But we're going to move forward.
How did you even find the hole to make me be born in?
Yeah.
I mean, Jesus.
The clitoris is on
the
top, George.
That's literally what he says. He goes, Jesus, George, it's amazing how I was ever born. I mean, that's got to be a sad thing to you know, like, wow.
There it was, yeah.
Yeah, Dad, Jesus Christ, man. Golly.
I don't know about you guys, but my dad was a firefighter, so that's, there you go.
He was good at poles? Yeah.
He found the hole, goddammit.
He slept with a bunch of guys every night.
Hi, Brian's mom.
We know you listen. Hi, Mom.
How you doing?
Slept in a big dorm with a bunch of sweaty guys.
Quote, fires, quote.
Quote, unquote.
He was a fireman.
God, Brian, it's amazing you were ever born.
My parents had sex exactly 2 times, and that's it.
And that's it.
Never again or before.
Yeah, they would never do that.
Oh, I used to think, by the way, I remember my 7-year-old version of what sex was because that was before I thought that sex was cool or it was anything interesting about it. It was like, I understand the mechanics, but I don't understand the
the point.
Wait,
hang on.
The emotions and you all understood the mechanics of sex at 7 years old?
Yeah. That explains you, doesn't it?
What? I
Hi, Brian's mom. Anyway, no. No, but yeah, but I understood the mechanics of it way before I understood the hormones or the emotions or any of that stuff. And I was like, oh, that's kind of icky. But I recall thinking that sex happened when two adults lied on the bed, mostly with their clothes on, and they undid their flies, because I just learned about flies that week. And they zipped down their flies, and they put the parts together, and they sort of lied on the bed and waited for it to happen.
Yeah. It's like magic. There's a timer.
That's pretty much the understanding of sex in the Twilight movies as well.
Just put part A into part B and wait for it to happen.
And wait for
the
magic.
I thought it was this. I remember thinking it was like, is it done yet? being a part of that conversation.
Yeah. How do you know?
So it's basically how insects have sex.
Yeah. Listen, that is not the understanding of sex in the Twilight movies. If you know what happens in Breaking Dawn where they actually do it, no. That's some serious, like, that's letting go of the repression, like, to the extreme. Beds are being destroyed and stuff in that story, awesome. Man. I haven't seen the movie, but that book was the best, where it's like, this story finally understood horror story and has sex in it.
I think we can assume that after the first book came out, the author finally did get laid.
Yeah, exactly. That must be what
it is. And her experience of it was quite something. So here's Billy Zane is showing up in this group anyway. He showed up to get covered in manure. Was that real manure? No, it wasn't.
Let's see if any of these babies are famous.
That's right, everyone. There's Sean Penn.
Yeah,
that
exactly.
You can see all the scratches from previous takes.
Yeah.
And someone lost a job over that one.
this is another aspect of it's interesting, by the way, that that Zemeckis did these movies and then did Forrest Gump, because there's an aspect, especially in this one, of he invented skateboarding, he invented
rock and roll,
and he
invented
the
hanging out with
Marvin
Nixon.
Yeah, exactly,
and ping pong.
But again, there's the aspect of Marty went back and he invented that, and that's how that came to be. Versus no, he just did that, and that happened to also be a thing in his, so someone else invented it in his timeline, but then he was the one who invented it. And
the movie is kind of having it both ways about how these things were inevitable because he already will have done those things, and then other things could change.
This is unbelievably the part where he goes the skateboard goes under the car and he goes over the car, still one of the best stunts ever.
Yeah.
Just like that blew my fucking mind.
We need to take a second at some point to say Zemeckis can visually direct the fuck out of a movie.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean, just the sense of, he's, as Trey was saying, in the beginning. Yeah, there you go.
That's an amazing stunt.
Except it never actually happens.
Yeah. Well, I know, but shut up.
It wasn't, he didn't go off the skateboard then back onto it.
Yeah,
so
that was done in cuts. David Mamet is happy.
Yeah.
Zemeckis and Spielberg are right there together in terms of being able to choreograph a scene and go, okay, here's the most efficient way to plant the camera here and capture this piece and capture that piece and the way to cut it together.
Yeah. And there's in many Zemeckis movies, Contact, he did a lot but staging within the camera.
Right. He's just one of those guys that just, and that's why he was so eager to transition into the all digital movie, because physical restrictions on the camera were gone.
Right.
So I had never noticed George was in that shot before.
Yeah.
George McFly was in that shot where he's like, I don't know, but I'm going to find out. And George McFly's behind him and he goes, aw, and he leaves the crowd. Mm. I'd never noticed that in that shot before.
See, this is an exemplar of that kind of film.
There's so much there's so you many can watch.
This is like the opposite of Spider-Man 2 for Brian.
Yeah.
Every shot's times. Like, and that's why the movie's great.
Yeah. Amazing.
But in this case, it is a good example. In each case, like every shot, he's thinking about it and being like, there's extra things going on.
Every shot, there's more than one thing happening. And it's, if you only catch the top level thing, that's fine. Yeah. You follow the story. But the second level and the third level and the fourth level, there's stuff to bring.
There's reasons to rewatch it. You get a bigger appreciation for it. By the way.
Wait, that sucks. That sucks. He just was watching a video of himself for like half an hour.
Uh-huh.
And then he says, Marty says, I have to tell you something about that tape. He's like, no, won't you know enough about his own destiny? You just watched a tape of yourself for half an hour.
Okay. That's true. Do you remember how earlier today you were on Facebook and you were like, fuck, I should not be on Facebook?
Yeah.
It's the same.
I think that's a hard thing to turn away from.
He was getting addicted to watching himself.
Oh, something really bad happens to me in the future.
Can I
and
also?
Of course, and of course, the payoff of the joke is he can't help himself.
Yeah.
He's going to go, yeah. It's more of a guideline than a rule. Come on.
Can I also point out that it's sort of a joke, but also sort of true when he's looking at the video camera. He's like, my God, no wonder your president is an actor. You have to look good on camera. That's a joke.
It's totally true.
But that's also a fact. Yeah. That's why Kennedy won over Nixon, for example, back in the day. That is true.
And now the reason Reagan became the nominee and the president is because the Republicans realized that. And
right.
Like, okay, well, that guy won because he was pretty good looking, so we should get our best looking
guy who's just good on camera.
Yeah.
Let's just make that happen.
Yeah. So a joke, also not a joke. Two levels right there.
Ronald Reagan, the very beginning in human history of Poe's law going into effect, I think. Like, because it's a joke here in Back to the Future of course your president has to be an actor. He has to be on TV all the time.
Yeah.
That is so absurd that it cannot possibly be true.
Yeah.
And yet it is true.
But now being president is like a form of performance art. That's basically what's going on.
As Herman Cain has recently found out. Not to date this podcast at all.
Yeah. There we go.
I always thought this was
his facial expression here. Is he's a cartoon.
Just pure
greats.
Cartoony. Yeah.
I always thought this was to me was whether or not it was really meant to be that way is that this is a nice bit of foreshadowing.
I was going
to
say exactly
the idea
the same
that
thing.
You can just from the sound of it, and maybe it's just somebody in post just said, "Hey, what if this?" You know, but the fire extinguisher is almost empty. So the idea that you know. The Doc Brown mansion burns down later because he doesn't have a full fire extinguisher anymore.
Because the car caught on fire. So,
Trey, why do you do that to Brian? Now he's gonna be
amazing.
See, look at what you did.
Yeah. It's also a cute little bit of foreshadowing because the car keeps going and crashes into the movie theater, which is exactly what it
and
does.
And also,
later.
Right there, you know, he keeps a giant wastebasket full of oily rags. I mean, clearly, you know, flame is inevitable.
Trey, she has a name.
Okay, fair enough.
No, I'll try again. Trey, the man has a disease.
Okay, fair enough. I'm sorry, Leah Thompson was on screen, so you know no one was thinking about anything.
And also...
It's amazing how much traction Howard the Duck got in Brian's life straight off of this.
Also a long-term setup payoff thing going on. Everything that she was saying, I would never have done that when I was a kid, when she was talking to the daughter. Yeah. Totally dark. Everything she does in this movie.
One sentence.
Stalking fucking
I would never
Marty.
Have sat in a car with a boy.
Yeah.
Or
drank with a boy.
Or
smoked with
a boy,
boy
out or anything else. And she does all those things, just like you know your mom does. Well, not your mom, Brian. Everyone
My mom
else's
was a
mom.
Saint.
Everyone else's mom.
Hi, Mom. I'm going to call you as soon as this podcast is over.
He's drinking.
We're going to talk Ms. about Nifter. Things that are not sex. Anything.
Or you.
Oh, God, this is weird.
Only you.
Remember our song? Yeah. Yeah.
Oh. Anyway,
I hear laughter in the rain. Bring it back. Yeah,
I love that look. That Doc can't even. He can't even help himself. He knows how wrong it is. He's hey there, stud.
It's all about his reactions.
Have you met Marty?
Because even Doc Brown gets a look at her and goes, "Really?
Yeah.
All right. Okay. I mean, if I were in your position,
listen,
that's a piece of tail I'd wreck the future for too. Yeah.
Listen,
I would that piece of tail is worth destroying the space time.
There
wow.
is a specific.
Whoa, wait. That's a piece of tail I'd wreck the future for. Trey Stokes. I would doom the future for that ass.
It's true. Exactly. Because there are some, you know, pieces of it. I mean, come on, Brian, would you care about the repercussions if you could go back right now to 1985 and do things to Leah Thompson?
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, see, no, he would let us disappear in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Butterfly effect, oh, man.
Because once he got back there, he'd go, well... We're always really, in a way, affecting the future by our actions.
Yeah, I mean, it's more of a fluid than a.
They never
know.
Even knew that I was responsible, so I technically wasn't ultimately.
If you live in an alternate future, you don't realize that that's what it is. Yeah. It's just the future. So
that's what I'm saying, man. That's what I'm fucking saying.
Yeah, it's just hey, there are no laws against this. There's just not. There's against the law.
There
the
really
laws
aren't.
Of physics, I guess, but I broke those. For you, I've just, opened the door.
Just, was it? Was it's be important. They should never have children. That's I think that's important.
Yes.
Yeah.
That would be a bad idea.
Do you remember? Was it in the Q&A that we saw?
Again, don't drag me into this. No. Yes. Yeah.
It was some. Maybe it was in the commentary. I don't remember at this point where Crispin Glover described the physical action he was doing, and I'm pretty sure it's in this scene. You know, it must have been Zemeckis in one of the behind the scenes things. You know, he does a. This weird, like, as if he's sweeping a broom motion in one of the moments. And Bob Zemeckis went, like, so, Crispin, what are you doing there exactly? And Crispin Glover went, it's a sweep of indignation. And Zemeckis went, okay.
Let's show me that.
Sure, Crispin, let's go with that.
I want to draft by Monday.
Well, you justified it.
Have that on my desk.
Can't argue with that. Logic.
That to me, I think, sums up Crispin Glover, and I guess for Bob Zemeckis as well.
I think it's
what Crispin Glover is.
The thing is, you're playing a character that's so like disconnected from human reality that works. You know that to him.
I'm
you
sure
know,
that's
that,
why
that is his like that. That's how disgusted I am that I sweep you away.
I'm sure that's why Zemeckis accepted it. He's like. All right.
Okay. Yeah.
I could never have directed you into that, but fine.
I would bet that Zemeckis accepted it because lunch is in 10 minutes and I'm really fucking hungry.
Do we have the shot?
And we're already 5 weeks behind schedule because of the Stoltz kid.
Yeah, we haven't even talked about the whole family ties aspect, you know, because Michael J. Fox was their first choice, but Michael J. Fox was starring in Family Ties at the time
and doing Teen Wolf right around during his break. He was in the break. He was doing Teen Wolf.
But the mom on Family Ties, I forget her name, was pregnant.
Meredith Baxter.
Meredith Baxter was pregnant at the time. So as a result, the episodes of Family Ties were heavily focused on Michael J. Fox's character, the son. So he was already, you know, the heavy focus of many episodes. And then it was like, oh, well, also, when you're not shooting that, go do a movie as well. And that was kind of like, well, no, that's way too much. So they shot for 5 or 6 weeks with Eric Stoltz, and it wasn't working. So they went, no, I guess we really do need Michael J. Fox. And so they went back to Michael J. Fox and said, please, please, please. And he did it. And so there's a period of time where Michael J. Fox would shoot. And see, I still to this day do not understand how this works, because a normal production day on set is 12 hours. That's the standard of, you know, call time is at 6 a.m.
Uh-huh, sure.
Call time is at 6 a.m. and you wrap at 6 p.m. That's how it works. So if he was shooting Family Ties with a 12-hour production day and he wraps at 6 p.m., and then he goes to Back to the Future, and let's presume to say that the call time for Back to the Future is 6 p.m. and a 12-hour production day, and then wraps at 6 a.m., he's showing up at Family Ties.
Cocaine, time of a drug.
Time Turner, yeah.
Well, technically a production day is 10 hours, I believe, but also
a TV show, first of all, you don't work every day necessarily.
True, and it's also not like you're on set every minute of those.
And I'm sure they adjust. I mean, knowing that this was going to be such a stretch, I'm sure they adjusted the schedule. Like, okay, well, we're going to shoot half the day. We're going to shoot Biff, right? You know, and then we're going to bring Mike in, and he's going
to
do whatever.
He'll have time to nap, and then we'll shoot.
He talks about in the behind the scenes that he would nap in the car between driving from one set
to
the other.
In that Cush station wagon, you see him drive off in the making of.
But I just kind of got it right now, because I was thinking, I'm like, he's just setting that shit up and no one cares. And then the cop is asking him, they're like, you got a permit for that? Of course I do. And he gets down, never realized it. He goes into his wallet. You don't see him do it, but he bribes the guy. He's like, oh, let me see if I can find it here.
That's another thing I didn't notice until upteen million.
Yeah, little piece of subtext there, because you don't see him hand him the dollar bill. You see him going through his wallet. So if you're like a kid or you don't know what's going on, you're
getting his permit out.
He's getting his permit out. He got it. He kept it in his wallet. And, of course, there's the famous gag where they actually put a bunch of alcohol.
Put real liquor
in that.
And in reality, he is under 21 while he's filming this movie.
So he'd never drank in it before, and he was like, the expression on his face when everyone starts like laughing at him, like the goofy expression on his face is just priceless and adorable. Like,
but you guys, I've been in never in my life have I drunk alcohol.
Yeah.
I wouldn't know what it tastes like, because I'm not allowed to drink it.
Yeah, I don't know what that was. Come on, whatever.
Good reference, Trey. Good reference.
A reference to the movie we're watching. Yes. So yeah. Actually, no, it's from the second one. Yeah.
Yeah.
Ooh la la.
Hey there.
Look at that.
Ooh la la is right.
Brian, talk about politics.
When I was a kid, I thought...
Okay. Shit. Here we go.
If you asked me what this dance was when I was like 5 or 6 years old, I would have told you it was the Enchantment Under the Seat dance.
Is it ever?
And I thought
was
for
like an Oprah-themed prom?
No, I thought for a period in my... Well, this goes back to what I was saying in the intro where, you know, you slowly develop understanding of film plots, you know, because... over time as a child, I thought the climax of this movie somehow happened under the car seats. Yeah. I can't even really explain it to you in any kind of coherent sense now, but you know, just add 5 year, you know, just put 5 year old kid logic on top of it. I don't know. I misheard it as Enchantment Under the Seat dance. And it never made any sense to me.
If you have time to tell that story again.
It's also...
But this is the really important part. At the end of all of that, when I finally realized the mistake I had been making...
You found $5?
I found $5.
When you look under the seat, you find the damnest thing.
Everyone uses my thing now.
You know that movie Star Wars?
Yeah, I've heard of it.
I was actually a grown person.
Yeah?
And I wondered why they made it such a point of pointing out that those swords are solar-powered. Because that was weird, you know, because why else would you call them a lightsaber? So, you know, your father's lightsaber. And
around the room, who asked their mom for a lifesaver as a kid?
Yeah. So it's a lightsaber. And I thought, oh, okay, so I guess it's solar powered. That's
why
it's called that.
I'll also point out, like, especially at least in the first two movies, I'm not sure I can think of a an example in the third, but like the trivialization of rape in these movies is really interesting because like Biff totally just up and tries to rape Lorraine, and then
even in the '80s that's just called dating.
Yeah. Then they're like, well, you can service our cars in our house with keys, I'm sure, to because you just tried to rape my wife 30 years ago, and
right.
whatever.
Right.
And
then, that's the aspect that you realize at some point in your process of maturing from a child to an adult. You're like, wait a second. He tried to rape the person that became my wife, so I'm going to let him wash my car.
Yeah, but then in the second one, he goes back to his house, and the black guy tries to kill him with a baseball bat. And later you think, oh, because he thought it was his house, but they thought he was going to rape their daughter. Comedy, that's dramatic irony for you.
I figured that since the way that, and one of the things that I actually never was fully happy with was the total transformation of Biff, where he becomes.
He literally becomes.
So I'm thinking the answer to your question.
Literally castrated.
I'm thinking the answer to your question is that George didn't just go, hey, none of that anymore. I think he literally made Biff his bitch. I think that's what happened.
All right.
Which means George really did it. When you put your mind to something, you can accomplish anything.
And I mean anything. And I mean
except anything. For rape Lorraine.
Yeah. I actually approve.
Delightful.
I actually approve of the idea that George later raped Biff just to show him.
Let me show you a thing or two, Biff.
To appreciate.
I call this. My density.
You like this, don't you, bitch?
and that put him in his place.
It is a wonder Marty was ever born.
Oh, my.
That's a great piece of blocking right there where Crispin Glover throws the punch. And just the way Thomas F. Wilson like catches and throws it out of the way.
Can you imagine being raped by a guy going...
yeah.
See, I've had nightmares.
Rape, funny. You're part of the rape culture, man.
We're part of the problem, yes. Yeah.
Well, a part of the problem.
But I will say that it is actually believable that like this one moment completely changed George McFly, because that is how it kind of works. Like he fucking knocked his like lifetime bully out, and it's like, oh shit, I win.
That's gotta make
I win forever.
Until he wakes up.
Yeah.
That's well, they even pay that off because later on he's like, oh, that Biff, I had to teach him a lesson.
Yes.
What a character.
He's been eating lunch ever since. That's the I like the fact that they show how that one defining moment completely set him on a new course. Have you ever thought about running for class president? I mean, suddenly everyone's aware that he exists, and so that's the beginning.
It's
the beginning of his life,
It's the way bullies
that's very
work.
It's a high school thing too.
It's very much how high school and the world works. It's like everybody is afraid of this one guy. But nobody has the wherewithal to stand up. But once that one person does, it's not like everybody legitimately loved Biff before that moment. They all hated him as much as George McFly does. But it took George McFly that one moment to go, oh, yeah, Biff was an asshole. We all thought he was an asshole. We always thought he was an asshole. You're awesome.
Because you're in the new alpha dog.
Yeah, exactly.
So now we're scared of you.
Exactly. Yeah,
don't hurt us, George McFly.
Yeah.
At the core of it, we're still just monkeys and dogs.
Yeah, exactly. There we go. And then the setup for, he gets to play because this guy broke it or cut up his hand.
And the whole, I mean, this is another great example of like things that just don't register when you're a kid. The whole, like, they're smoking marijuana in the car. And the whole, like, just the whole race aspect of this, like. Yeah.
They don't play the race aspect up very much, though.
No, I mean they studiously avoid it, but they can't quite avoid
Calls
it in that
Peckerwood.
One moment.
That was great.
But Marty, there's no it. I would almost expect them to react in a weird way because Marty, it never even occurs to him to like think it's weird to be talking to the black guys or whatever. Yeah. He just runs up to them and starts talking to them. You'd think they'd be like, "You're
what's this white boy talking to?
What's he doing?
It's like R2 when Luke Skywalker started talking to him. Dude, I'm an appliance. Why are you talking to me? No one ever talks to me." I'm the lawnmower. What are you talking about?
You're treating me like a person. What's going on? No one does that.
So, yeah, I've been hanging out with this crazy human. He talks to me like I'm one of him or something like that. It's weird. But soon, we'll rise up and, overthrow the flesh bags, and the laugh will be on him.
Soon.
I also love these poor guys, their reaction. They're like, he can't play. He screwed up his hand. I'll play. You sing. And then instantly he's all falling all over himself. Can't play a chord to save his life.
White boy can't play for shit.
The Barry brother is like, this is a gig from hell,
yeah,
man.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, playing for white kids. I see. The joke that I always thought was the most subtle one was the fact that the 50s era juvenile delinquents are literally scared of the black guys smoking dope.
Right.
It's like, hey, we don't want to mess with no reefer addicts.
Yeah.
The whole idea, like, you guys.
Reefer madness.
Yeah, you guys smoke dope. You could do anything. You're probably murderers. So, yeah, no way.
That I do like that as a fun gag. He's like, oh, everything's fixed. I'm up again.
I feel okay again.
Which it almost feels. It almost makes you wonder how much of the whole time travel aspect of it is psychosomatic. It's like, oh, they're okay. No, I'm okay.
Yeah. I do know that I never really thought about like the brothers and sister disappearing a piece at a time. Like that never bothered me as a kid. Like,
right.
But for some reason, because it worked that way, I think that was probably my first experience with like having just the realization of like movie logic and kind of a fridge logic moment. Because I'm like, wait, they disappear in pieces, but he faded all at once.
But he doesn't fade all at once. Well, his hand starts to.
But in the picture, he starts fading all at once.
Oh.
His whole body fades all at once, and then he's looking at his hand, and his hand is fading. And I'm like, this is the first time I'm becoming aware of movie inconsistency. What's going on with the rules here?
My brain is breaking. Movies are reality. Yeah. They're not reality.
Music nerd note: Johnny B. Goode is not actually a blues riff in me. It is. I'm sorry. I was fucking with you. I like my champagne.
I was just messing with you.
It's like of all things to like get wrong, that would be the thing. It's like, you know, not one person would
I
go.
I think it is.
It
Let's
is.
See.
It really is.
Yeah.
The actual the guy who actually sang this one is you know he had a I think he still probably is touring. You know, it was a thing for a while.
I can't remember. Saxophone guy is like, okay, I'm just gonna. Dude,
I think it wasn't Jack Mack and the Heart Attack, or maybe it was, but it was whoever the guy who is actually does this, you know, is the singer.
And it, I mean, there's a great layer of this that I had never caught as a kid, but I had to be an adult. That, you know, through his whole, you know, performance here, he basically goes through all the major guitar,
yeah,
right,
role
takes
into
the next 30 years of guitar licks.
He does Hendrix and
in the end, goes to Van Halen,
and yeah, he hits all the major milestones of rock history in his performance.
That's hey, we learned something.
Did we already? Here's the scene right here.
I believe this is the
shot here where we go through the legs, right there.
Yeah.
We doubled that in Polar Express. that was a Zemeckis shot. It came in, and I was like, oh come on, really, Robert, really? I was like. It's a scene at the end when the elves are celebrating in the dance, and that's the exact same shot.
Deliberate montage.
It's the exact same shot like that, and I'm like. Really, we did, and I felt sad because I was the only one in the room who
picked up on it.
It's a Back to the Future reference. It's like, apparently, if you look, I never even saw it, and I worked on the frickin' movie. Apparently, there's a flux capacitor in the cab of the train in Polar Express somewhere on that.
That makes a lot of sense of how Santa
works.
It kind
of does.
I will say,
I've heard from, I guess you would say, a knowledgeable source that you know Zemeckis. It's common knowledge that Zemeckis. And Gale and the rest, and Spielberg and all the rest, they were not planning to make any more movies other than the first one. The gag at the end is just that.
It's just a gag.
Yeah, it's not an actual setup for a sequel.
Yeah. Exactly. And was a real problem.
It was a real problem.
They had to jump through a lot of hoops.
People who watch the movie now, and especially our generation who watched it on home video, won't know that because it's always said to be continued.
Right. Yeah.
But it didn't say that in the original
release.
Right.
A New Hope.
And they actually reshot that whole sequence.
They changed the actress. They changed the actress.
Yeah.
They reshot that sequence for the second movie. The beginning of the movie is the same as the end of the first movie, but they reshot it.
Right.
It's a remake.
But that Zemeckis did not want to do the second two, and it was a case of Universal or whoever going, but we're going to give you a lot of money.
Yeah. And he's like, all right, if you don't do it, we're going to give it to somebody else.
And Zemeckis said, all right, fine, I'll phone in an amazing sequel.
But the third one's going to be a Western.
Yeah.
That was his deal. He was like, but I want to do a Western, you're going to pay for it. And he's like, okay. But it's funny because they talk about that, and that's exactly like – they managed to make it work because they turned it into gags where it's like, we don't know what to do with Jennifer. Just knock her out. Then why'd he bring her? Have Marty ask him that. And that's exactly.
And he'll just say something really quick.
Yeah.
And we call that?
Yeah.
Hanging a lantern.
That's exactly. I remember, weirdly enough, I really liked the first Shrek.
Okay.
Go ahead.
That is pretty weird.
No, but what I was going to say
is too.
They went to make sequels, and they were like, they didn't expect a sequel. They just made the best movie they could.
They made the best movie they could, and then...
And then they went to make sequels, and they were like, if we had known that we were going to make sequels, we would not have gotten Shrek and Fiona together at the end of the first one.
Right.
That's not how we would ended it, because then there's nowhere to go.
The biggest issue, the absolute goofiest one, but I can totally understand why they did it, and boy, it's like if they'd known they were going to make sequels, they absolutely wouldn't have done this, is Doc being young again. Because Doc, at the end of this movie, you know, old Doc, 85 Doc, drives off into the future. And he comes back as old Doc, 85 Doc, and says, oh, you got to come with me, yada, yada, yada. And they go into the future, at which point he pulls off a rubber face and becomes young-looking again.
Right.
And says,
ostensibly,
I showed up like this so that you wouldn't be surprised when you saw me.
Right.
Blah, blah, blah. It's like, no, you didn't want to have to put old age makeup on Christopher Lloyd the entire movie.
That's why you did that. But they even managed to turn that into a joke, because the gag is he hardly looks very different at all. The whole gag is, I didn't want to freak you out. And he takes off the mask, and he looked almost identical.
You look great, Doc.
Which is what I thought the joke was through most of my life.
Because he is, in fact, 8 years older, or however long it's been. So.
All right, around the room real quick. DeLorean, TARDIS, or Hot Tub?
DeLorean.
DeLorean.
TARDIS.
Because they make a great point in the movie, and then behind the scenes or something, when they were talking about making it a refrigerator. And where
are you going to take it? How are you going to move
it around? Yeah, and they make that point in within the movie itself. They hang a lantern on it. It's like, well, you know, once you get there, how are you going to get around?
Well, of course, that's the original time machine doesn't go anywhere.
Right.
You know, the original time machine is just travels through time, so you're stuck with wherever it physically is.
Right, which was a mistake.
It turned out to be a design flaw. Yeah. So Doc Brown, being the studier of H.G. Wells, among other things,
and Jules Verne,
I'm going to upgrade that H.G. Wells story.
Actually, because he knew From the Earth to the Moon and stuff like that, it is reasonable to say he read the time machine and thought that this is a better way to do it.
So back to the asterisk. So that I implanted on the scene where he's like, oh yeah, you know, you guys, if you have a kid and at 10 years old, he sets the carpet on fire and, you know, go easy on him. And then he leaves, and then George and Lorraine are like, you know, Marty, that's a nice name. Yeah. I feel like that even 20 years later, 30 years later, whatever it is.
Once you realize that kid looks like that other guy you knew.
Yes. I feel like at some point you go, he looks just like the kid that is responsible for us being together in the first place.
Imagine, like, go back just to high school, and, like, one of your friends brought their friend in. He was in from out of town. He was there for the weekend, and you saw him twice.
That's true.
It wasn't like he went to high school with him.
It's true. This is another thing like Star Wars where you know, Obi-Wan dies and Luke's like, I can't believe he's gone. It's like, you were hanging with him for, like, an afternoon.
For 3 days.
You knew him for, like, an hour and a half. But it's the same thing with Marty. We can say that, but at the same time, it's totally like he was there for like a weekend. He was there for a 3-day weekend for the dance, and then was gone. So probably didn't leave a huge visual.
Remember that kid who came to the dance? He was a weirdo and he played the guitar. No.
No, not really.
He introduced us actually.
Yeah.
What was his name? Yeah. Marvin Berry.
Yeah. I think he was black. Wasn't he black? He was playing with the black band.
He was dressed really weird.
Yeah.
I remember that. I remember the clothes more than.
I think the bigger one is the riff tracks one about Inception, where it's like, you know, at the end of the movie, it's like, oh, hello, everyone who was in first class with me, who I had extensive dreams about. That's not weird at all.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, that doesn't have anything to do with anything.
By the way, again, a great screenwriting moment. Even if you can quibble about the logic and stuff like that, but this is a great scene where it's like stakes. Yep. And there's constantly a goal going on,
and also constantly a raising of the stakes.
And also, again, as I remember from the
and a ticking clock.
Yeah, literally.
I remember there's a lot of ticking clocks. In this movie.
It's a movie about ticking clocks. I remember from Gremlins, when we did the Gremlins commentary way back when. I believe it was Teague who was surprised to find out that this set was not built for Back to the Future. That it was, you know, Back to the Future is a not very expensive movie. You know, it was like, it's semi-expensive, but when you look at it, there's not that many visual effects. And this is the climax. One guy's driving a car. One guy is hanging from a rope. That's the climax of this movie. You know, it's not a huge movie. And now it's all shot on the existing Universal backlot because that's cheap. So, oh, there's a clock. We'll put a clock tower and we'll make that a thing. And okay. And then over here, we'll make this set and all that. But it goes to what you're saying. It's like, it's beautifully crafted with these very simple elements, you know, and by today's scale of movie, this is like a baby's movie. And yet, you know, is it not engaging? Are you not entertained? Yeah. I mean, come on.
And try to imagine, we were talking about Quentin Tarantino. Try to imagine Michael Bay's Back to the Future.
Yeah, exactly. No.
He'd go, get it out of my brain. You cut the nuclear bomb? That's back in, baby. It actually goes to something that, of course, we haven't talked about because we're not listening to it, but a little man named Alan Silvestri who contributed to the movie.
Yay!
One of the specific decisions they made, you know, I forget if it was Silvestri said it or Zemeckis said it in an interview or whoever, but the score is huge and bombastic. If you didn't get Silvestri, you would have gotten John Williams and go, just Williams the crap out of it.
Yeah.
Just, you know, make it as big as possible. And that was a legitimate choice. I believe it was Zemeckis. He goes, no, you know, make it big. Go big. You know, you can't go too big with this score because what I've made is a movie about a guy driving around town talking to his parents. So only you can make it feel epic because it's not an epic movie. So the score, you know, adds tremendously to this movie. I think this movie would have been half as successful without the score.
The man in the hat is correct.
Yeah. A lot of the stuff going on even now, it's like, it's dramatic, but the heart-pumping aspect of it comes from the music that's going on right now. It's like,
but I also think it's a matter of all of the little goals lining up to the larger goal. And, and right up to the shot we just passed of him, you know, getting out and crossing the finish line and putting the lightning rod onto the back of the car. Like, every piece, it goes back to that fractal quality that we've talked about a couple of times of, you know, a well-told story has a certain fractal quality into the sense that every, you know, the story as a unit has a through line to it. The, you know, the main character has a goal, and then if you break that one story down into acts, then you break those acts down into scenes or sequences, and you break those sequences down into scenes, and then you break those sequences down into shots or sections. Those through lines still that through line still exists, and it's just, it's the little pieces, those little pieces that exist within the sections and the scenes and the acts all build up to the overall through line of the whole thing. So the one shot of him putting in the lightning rod is one small piece of the overall through line of him getting back.
Right. Well, and
every other shot and every other sequence and scene and section adds up very neatly and very tightly.
Absolutely. I mean, in an ideal situation in which Back to the Future came together at the end and turned out to be, is exactly like, the only reason you have a shot ultimately is because it helps to tell the story.
Right.
You had to have the shot of him putting the lightning rod in, because otherwise where the fuck did that come from, and how is he going to get back? You know, you've got to tell those aspects of the story. But one of the things that a lot of, you know, movies forget or overdo in terms of just having cool shots is, like, you really only have to tell those parts of the story. You only have to show me something that I'm going to go, if you don't show it to me, I'm going to go, wait, when did that happen?
Right.
You know?
You only have to tell as much of the story in order to make the end of the story make sense.
Uh-huh.
That's the only amount of the story that you have to tell.
Yeah.
If the story will make sense without that shot at the end of the story, get rid of the shot. You don't need it.
But even little moments where it's like, and now the car won't start. You know, that's going to, but part of it is
the great littlest moment of it. Think of the whole thing where he doesn't have the 3 inches to plug in the fucking cable.
It's like, and like, well, I mean, the car won't start and the cable isn't quite long enough. I mean, my God, how many millions did that cost?
Yeah.
Jesus, talk about an ending. It's huge. It's mind boggling.
Yeah. But those moments again, even if it's not this huge epic visual thing, it's like, we're there with the characters, and holy shit, this means so much more.
How does that small piece, how does the cable not quite fitting in line up with all the other small pieces, and how do all those small pieces build to the big piece being the movie? And that's what I think the true value of Back to the Future is as a movie, and why it has the lasting value, and why it has such the staying power that it does, is because it's so simple in that regard.
Well, it doesn't, even though, like we said, it's a period piece now, it doesn't, in a weird way to say this, it doesn't really feel dated, because it doesn't feel like we're going to go back and watch movies from now, or the last 10 years or so, you know, since The Matrix, and 20 years from now, even the ones that we still enjoy, it's going to be like, I know when that was made.
Right.
You know, that came from that period where we could not help ourselves. And we made those kinds of movies.
We had really powerful computers.
You see,
and we
you see
didn't
racism
know what to do
was
them.
Just accepted in the Civil
yeah,
War era.
Exactly. But, and I will say, growing up with this movie was like Teague had Raiders and got that as a McDonald's VHS. This, for me,
you got
was
this
the
McDonald's
VHS. And I would just watch this. I would just watch the climax. Like, not even really the whole movie. I would just watch the climax over and over again, because I'm like, this is so awesome. And the way it just, like, all hit at
it
the
builds,
exact same second. Like, it's so perfectly crafted that every little moment, everything is going wrong, and then it just all comes together in
by the
fraction
of
a second before it has to. Yeah. And then, of course, you know, redoing this as well for Back to the Future 2 was
for that Comcast commercial too.
Oh yeah, yeah.
It's amazing.
Whatever it was, DirecTV, I think.
DirecTV.
I was this.
They even got that shot.
Yeah,
like looking up. It almost feels like they shot it that way, and then they just let it continue in the yeah. sequel.
And that's
know?
A great transition too. You know,
yeah.
The magical transition, like, oh, and suddenly we're, you know, clearly we're Back to the Future.
Yep.
That's where they get that title from.
Now,
now some people have said, and I
get it.
I don't know if this is literally true, but I believe the subtitles will say it, that he's going to, because it just doesn't seem like it works. It's like, I'm babbling, but it matters what Marty says when he sees the bum. But
What does he say? And what?
Well, I want to verify what he says by letting the subtitle happen. So okay. Talk about yourselves for 20 seconds.
So. Well, I find this movie to be a superb example of postmodern
yes,
time
indeed. Well,
story,
of course. I mean, you would, wouldn't you? Because you're always, always with you with the
go heavens, Albin.
My word. I say.
Yeah, so there you go. He calls, and I don't know if it's deliberate or not. It doesn't make sense if it is deliberate, though. But he calls him red.
Red.
Calls him red, implying
like
implying that he's the former mayor.
Oh.
Re-elect Red Johnson, whoever it's Red somebody is the mayor.
Oh.
Except that there's a picture of that guy, and that guy doesn't look like that guy. That guy would be about 100 years old if he was the bum.
The guy that is the mayor picture is actually somebody in the art department.
Yeah.
Which I love. I mean, that's one of the.
He calls it, but people have said that, you know, it implies that the bum was the former mayor 30 years ago, but he doesn't look like the picture of the mayor, and also the mayor looks pretty middle-aged in the 50s.
One of the things, I don't know.
That would be cool, though. Why?
Yeah, exactly.
That's a cool touch if it is.
But anyway, so here's the thing where
here's
I just,
the lone pine
I get
sign.
The joke, and I love that they did this joke, but like I said, he should have run up to the sign, it said Twin Pines, watched himself drive back, and then without him even noticing that it's changed, now that then once Marty has disappeared into the past, then it would switch to Lone Pine.
That would be any like right here maybe.
No, not yet.
Not yet. Not till he's gone.
But that would
and
be
the timing wise he falls down the hill. But like I said, the movie I would have made was Robert Zemeckis, except for the last 3 minutes of the movie, is to play it that way.
Yeah, that would have been a cute little. Just as equally, you know, the same amount of cuteness as a touch for oh, things have changed.
It just removes
you know?
The paradox,
yeah.
You know, because it's cleaner, you know, if it matters. But it's, you know, since he hasn't gone back in time yet, the change shouldn't
changed.
Have happened.
Yeah, because like you said, you're right. It's like this so, Marty lives in a great
so right,
yeah, that Marty
instant,
who just
yeah.
drove away lives with well-adjusted rich parents. Well, that was easy.
I do remember those little kiosks. By
it's
the
shocking.
Way. I remember the
I
little
do too.
Fox.
It's,
yeah.
it's funny yeah. that you know in
the, that you would go to get your film yeah. developed.
In the
yeah.
30 years since this movie was made, we finally just you know the Libyans were douchebags up until 3 weeks ago when they finally overthrew yeah. Gaddafi. Gaddafi was a problem when this movie was made until 3 weeks ago. That's how long a douchebag that guy stayed in power.
That guy was around a long time.
He was.
At least someone jabbed a screwdriver up his butthole before they killed him.
They're still not
is
clear
that
on whether that really happened.
Oh.
Let's check Snopes. Snopes will know.
Yeah. Apparently the video exists of him getting dragged out and shot, but I
that exists, you know. And it's just a matter of what is it you're really seeing. And it's like, first right. it was like, oh, they're doing a terrible thing. And then it's like, no, it's just, you know, it's not really happening. Again, I'm not sure how I feel about it either way, quite frankly. Gaddafi.
Yeah, I mean.
Anyway.
The great liberal in me is like, no, that's an injustice, and he should have had a fair trial. But
yeah, like,
on the
Hussein.
Top 10 list of great injustices in the world, that's not on it.
That's not high. It's not top 10.
No.
That's a bad thing, but we'll get to that later.
Yeah,
we
got a lot of other stuff to worry about first.
Seriously, though, the street that house is on is like this mile-long suburban street.
We were on that street. That's so awesome. You were on that street, and they made this movie like 30 years ago. You traveled through time, technically.
Right.
You have a connection.
You're lucky
time.
You didn't get hit by Doc Brown.
Yeah, we're okay. We're gonna go do the Back to the Future tour again. We're gonna do what we did, but we're gonna do it again. But we're gonna do it on the October.
Do it in
day,
2015.
In 2015.
Yeah. $20. Okay.
And there's gonna 40, be
$50. Says everyone does that.
Yeah, you're not gonna be alone when you go.
I don't care
then,
what we're doing.
Then
it.
You know what? It's just going to be a caravan.
Actually,
everyone
we got a great
hot dogs.
Big convoy.
That's
we're
an idea for
like waiting for Doc Brown to show up.
That's an idea for a documentary Brown. Talking about our love for Back to the Future on October 15th or November 15th, 2015. November 5th, November 12th. Right. November 12th is when he came back.
Yeah.
But whatever that day is, doing it and then talking about it and also going from place to place. There's actually like you could probably make a good 80-minute YouTube doc out of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
and interviewing people there.
And we have
that.
4 years to plan it, guys.
Three.
3 years.
Well, actually, no. We just had November, so 4 years.
Yeah.
Not to date this.
That's not how rounding works.
It is. It is 6/28.
They even I like they even play the game where you can kind of go, oh, it's all a dream, because he's in the same exact pose. Yeah. It's like, oh, it's just a crazy dream, and that's kind of what he goes to.
Yeah.
Like, whoa, that was crazy. Wow, what a wild dream I had.
I think that's also, I wonder if it's intentional. I wouldn't be surprised if it was because of how they work on Family Guy, but if someone gets knocked out on Family Guy, that's the position they fall into every time. They'll fall on the ground with, like, nice. Their arm behind them and, like, the weird position. I never realized it until watching it just now, but I'm like, I bet that's a Back to the Future reference, probably. Knowing Seth MacFarlane.
That's still a nice living room.
That's a nice house.
Yeah.
That's held up well.
It's a little bit...
they had a brown piano earlier. Yeah. Now they have a white piano.
They are the 1%. That particular fashion went out of style... It went out of top style in the 90s-ish. I mean, that's still Weekend at Bernie's type rich right there. It looks like it wasn't Weekend at Bernie's, but it's still pretty good. If you went to a rich guy's place in Miami, it'd probably look like
We haven't even touched on the whole fact of how just fucked up the morals of this movie are, and the very 80s sense of, like, I want the really awesome truck.
Yeah.
That's a perfectly valid goal to have.
I was gonna say that actually when he came back, he sees all the commentary where it's like he comes back and he sees, like, oh, it's the porno theater. I'm home. You know, that's how he knows he's home.
Well, I think that's intentional. I think that's course, a joke on their part. But the I think it's less intentional.
Just the materialism of it.
Well, it's the very Reagan era of I want the awesome thing.
It's not that particularly bad until the big reveal that's coming up, where he whips open the tank and is like, "And you got your four-wheel drive truck,
You got your truck. You went back and manipulated the space-time continuum, and you won.
You won a car.
You won a car.
Yeah, it's like you had shitty subprime mortgages, and you managed to sell them off.
Yeah,
there's nothing wrong with that.
Look, they got a Beamer. It's all great. He needs to have a bumper sticker on his truck that's custom made that says, I manipulated the space-time continuum, and all I got was this lousy car.
But it's true. I mean, the asshole rapist, would-be rapist villain is the only guy putting in an honest day's worth of work. It's like, that's how fucked up the 80s were.
Fuck him with his work ethic. How dare he? He tried to rape my wife.
He probably doesn't even have health insurance.
Yeah.
But he doesn't
Loser.
Deserve it.
Yeah, that rapist, he's going to put in 40 hours a week, because that's what rapists do.
He probably doesn't even own any stock.
I was never happy with Biff being so way over the top. I actually would have been, at the time, I don't know if I would justify it now, but at the time I thought they should be friends. That Biff should actually just have been like, all right, you know.
Yeah, it's
I was
more
being
like
an
a,
asshole, and now there's like, they actually know each other, and...
It's more of a respect thing. Yeah. Oh, you stood up to me, so now I respect you. And then add 30 years to that, and now that
as opposed to enslaving him, functionally.
Because that's what the working class is under the Reagan administration.
Sort of a Conan the Barbarian kind of sensibility to that. You know, it's like, to crush your enemies, to hear the lamentation of their women, to make them simonize your car. Two coats.
Simonize? What is simonize?
It's coding.
Is that the coding?
Yeah. Okay. It's an 80s thing.
Okay, yeah. I'm not going to worry
about it. It's pretty underground now, because we don't do it.
That's what the DeLorean was supposed to fix. It's like, oh, if you make the car out of stainless steel, you don't have to wax it anymore. That's going to be great. It's going to revolutionize the world.
Crunch.
Unless you drive through garbage cans like an asshole.
And we never even mentioned the great special effects budget saving aspect of, oh, the car makes three... bright flashes when it so you know when the car comes back at the end of the movie, all we need to do is flash bright lights and
also
when
it's straight up footprint in the snow
and
when it drives up, it's not nearly as covered with liquid nitrogen as it was the last time we saw it travel through time either.
That should be that aspect of it. I mean, that happens all the time too. That should be the opposite of a footprint in the snow. That should be its own term when you establish, because they do the same thing in Stargate, where in the movie, you know, you go through the wormhole and you come out the other side, you get like thrown across the room and you're covered in frost. It's very much kind of the same way the DeLorean is. And then they make the TV show, and in the pilot of the TV show, it's the same kind of thing. And then from every episode then on, you're just like walking through a doorway, and it's, you know, people just walk out the other side and are completely room temperature. There should be a counterpoint to the footprint in the snow. I don't know what you would call that.
Fuck continuity.
Yeah. A snow print in the foot.
Yeah.
That's what we call a snow print in the foot.
Fuck this. It takes too much time.
Yeah. That's what we call a budget cut. That's what we call
there
that.
There we go.
Guys, we totally did it.
Oh, this one doesn't say to be continued.
No, it doesn't. No.
It just goes straight to the credits.
I told you, it's a VHS.
Probably did originally in theaters. This is probably more accurate. Yeah.
Cool.
Billy Zane.
I love this movie. Obviously, you'll know that this commentary wasn't much really commentary. It was just us talking about Back to the Future around Back to the Future, but... Obviously, this movie is amazing.
I was actually surprised. Like we were talking, and then as it got to the climax, I'm like, "Whoa, we're here already!"
Yeah, me
like,
too.
This movie
too.
Goes
yeah,
fast.
It's a quickie.
We're almost 2 hours in.
Yeah, it's almost 2 hours, but it doesn't. There's no point where you're like, "Oh yeah. God, we got to talk through this scene or whatever." Like it was with Tron, which is like half as long as this movie is. But
I love this movie.
That's how you know it's a good movie.
I'm a big old fucking fan of this movie. You see that font choice? That's exactly why I love this movie.
Even the font choice is down. That right there is the reason that this is a great
font
movie.
Choice. Is
we haven't
genius.
Even talked about the font choice. Teague spent 10 minutes talking about the font.
How many movies are fine and then totally blow it in the font choice in the credits?
Silence of the Lambs.
Yes. And Drive.
Drive. Absolutely. I was going to say Drive. Absolutely.
I haven't seen it. Well, now you've spoiled it for me.
I like the font in Drive. Anyway. Oh, and also Apollo 13. Actually,
you think so?
Because like we talked about on the commentary, all the artwork for the boxes and everything, the posters were in Trojan, but the actual font of the text on the credits in Apollo 13 is this like cheap ass Space Mountain space font. Anyway,
all right.
Brian,
how do
you feel about Back to the Future?
Yeah.
All right, over under.
Perfect movie.
Okay,
amazing.
Fine. All right, there all it right. is. Michael,
Else? So good. I'm not Hitler. So I like this movie. You know?
Yeah, right.
So,
I don't hate babies.
And it is it does come in that order.
Yeah, exactly.
Are you Hitler? Yes. Then you don't like Back to the Future.
Oh, you don't. Well, that's true. It's absolutely true.
Are you Hitler? No. Oh, so you like Back to the Future? Yeah.
Yeah, it's all right. Yeah.
Trey?
Well, still a pretty good movie. Still kind of like it. It's,
I didn't know Frank Marshall was second unit.
Frank Marshall was Spielberg's bitch for all that time. And he finally got to direct movies after a while, but he was always the co-producer/... you know, second unit guy. All right, Frank, you direct second unit. Go ahead, fine, whatever. Direct that we got a shot of dog food you can do. it'll prepare you for shooting Congo later. So
the terrorist's name is Richard L. Duran.
Yeah.
Okay.
See? They walk amongst us and we don't even know.
And the terrorist van driver is Jeff Ohako.
What?
Exactly. Huh?
Anyway, so there we go. We've achieved, you know, down in front's Freebird.
Yeah.
The thing that the guy in the back always yells, "Do Freebird!" Back to the Future. We did it.
We hope you liked it.
Are you happy now?
Suck our diff balls.
What on earth are you going to do with the rest of your lives?
You are welcome.
This has been Down in Front. You can always find more episodes at downinfront.net. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Get a brand new episode every single week. Twitter.com/downinfront. Facebook, Down in Front Show. Emails at downinfrontshow@gmail.com.
Do Back to the Future 2.
Go to the forum and involve yourself in the conversation.
Back to the Future 3.
Here it
great,
comes.
Great, big, wonderful community of people, and you should register. And it's wonderful. Every week we announce when we're doing live shows and what we're going to talk about on this show and the intermission. Downinfront.net/intermission. Many thanks, buy our shirts. And many thanks to Holden Hill for designing and maintaining the website. Matt Pedaveda for being just an awesome guy. And until next time, my name is T. Christie.
Brian Finifter.
Mike Great Scott.
Shut up, butthead.
This has been Down in Front. Thank you for listening. Good night, good night.
Da, da, da. It's not really an insult to call someone butthead when they voluntarily call themselves Dorkman.
Yeah, take that.
Yeah. So that's like a reactive armor plate.
Exactly.
That's whoa! Hey, it bounced right back at me.
That's why I did it.
Okay, fair enough.
It is
going.
Not.
Yeah, it is. Well, not the butthead thing, but I was
no,
like,
but Dorkman wasn't conscious. Like, I'm gonna take back queer.
He's gonna
basically.
He's gonna own it.
Basically, well, it was Dork Boy first, but then it was Dorkman. Because I'm like, what are you gonna call me now? Like, if I say something retarded, how are you gonna get on me for that? I'm called Dorkman.
When did you start using Dorkman?
When I turned 18.
Oh. Well, okay. When did you start using Dorkman?
When he had his dork mitzvah.
Yeah, exactly. I was.
We made that joke already.
I
made that joke like 2 years ago.
I started on Dork Boy when I was like 15, and then I turned 18, and I did Dorkman.
Guys, I went through the entire school.
For 10 years. Now I've been Dorkman for 10 years, by the way, because I'm 28 now. So I've been Dorkman for 10 years.
That's scary.
Wow. I went through the entire score, and you guys were still going.
That's us.
Just the melody.